today we are going to have three entities which are going to interact with us as the portfolio committee. The first one is the National Consumer Commission, our two-year-old baby. We want to see whether he or she is running fast enough now. And then the second briefing will be that from the CIPC. And the last one is from the ECIC. So if you can look at the program for today, it's very interesting because we start with the consumers early in the morning. And then as the day gets older, we deal really with the tough stuff of how we create, how we grow this economy to ensure that our consumers are better off, so that they can have the money to spend, so that the commission can have their work. Because the more money they spend, the more problems they're going to encounter, then the commission will be coming into the rescue as we're doing that. So first of all, I'd like to welcome each and everyone in this room. First of all, the members of parliament who are so diligent. I know that today, this week is the committee week, but this committee has been scheduled to sit from Tuesday until today. So it's one of the most hardworking committees to come across here in parliament. And then also welcome the staff from the department who are always there doing their diligent work, timelessly, working their corners like the clocks. You know the clocks, it's there in the corner, but it's always working for 24 hours a day. Our staff from the department is like the clock, right? And then of course we'll welcome the entity which is in front of us, which is the NCC, plus the people who are interested in their work, in our work, that is the media, and then of course the backbone of the portfolio committee, the support staff of the portfolio committee. You are all welcome in this meeting. Secretary of the committee, are there any apologies for today?
Chairperson, we have apologies from Ms. Hub, who is attending a meeting in Johannesburg, Mr. Mabasa, who is probably part of the strategic workshop with EDD, Mr. Ambrosini, who will submit an apology for the whole of the week, and Mr. Salau, who will be arriving late due to traffic. So what do you want to say? And Mr. Kovasa also will be arriving. It's a strategy meeting. We'll be arriving.
All right, thank you for that. I think that those apologies are reasonable and they'll accept them. All right, as I said that we've got three items on the agenda for today. These are the three entities we're going to deal with, the NCC, CIPC, and CIC. Is there anyone who can propose the adoption of this agenda? Honorable Eloise? By Mr. McIntosh. Thank you. Without further ado, we are having the delegation from the NCC, which is led by the Commissioner, Mr. Mohammed. And then I can see that we have PAPS, we have Prudence, we have Cabo, we have OC, the guys from the legal team, the legal part of this. I can see that we have had a lot of legal challenges on the side of the NCC. We have to come and explain today why are we having so many legal challenges at the Commission. So guys, we are welcome in this meeting. And then without wasting any time, I think that we must, because we're having three entities, let's give each and entity about 1 hour, 30 minutes for presentation, 30 minutes for engagement with the reporter keeping in front of us. So the time now is 9:22. It is that by 10:22 we must be finished with this. But what is very important is that the only word which is correct is the one. All the others are wrong. Thank you. You can go on, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to all the honourable members and everybody else present here today. And thank you for this opportunity. The presentation that I'm about to deliver deals with the strategic plan and the annual performance plan of the National Consumer Commission. The National Consumer Commission has revised its strategy. And in large part, what I'm going to be saying here today is going to be explaining the reasons for the revision of that strategy. The Commission is mandated to administer the CPA, the Consumer Protection Act, and is established and began its mandate in April 2011. It attracts substantial interest from the broader public, and where the incidence of thousands of complaints that came rushing into the NCC. And this happened in a short period of time. Arguably, there existed a substantial responsibility on the NCC at the time to assist with the received complaints while still at this institution building stage. An emphasis was placed on the resolution of complaints, whilst, on the other hand, corporate governance and due processes necessary for the operation of an efficient public entity was lacking. I continue with the background. An analysis revealed that much of the NCC's work revolved around, as I said, the resolution of complaints, which was primarily the conciliating of disputes between business and consumers. In many instances, where businesses were found to have acted unfairly, consent orders and compliance notices were issued. In issuing such orders and notices, it was found that in many cases, due process was not followed. However, in several instances, businesses have held the view that they settled in favor of consumers as it was not cost-effective to oppose the orders and notices. The end result, however, was that hundreds of consumers benefited. Certain businesses, however, successfully contested compliance notices. This resulted in adverse publicity for the NCC and also a hugely inflated legal bill. The CPA, however, in terms of Section 99 of the Act, specifically stipulates that the NCC is responsible to promote the resolution of disputes arising in terms of the Act, but is not directly responsible to intervene in or directly adjudicate any such dispute. This means, what does this mean? It talks about the promotion of the resolution of disputes and not the intervention or direct adjudication of any such dispute. This shall become clearer later in my presentation. In several matters, the NCC had acted beyond its powers. A further analysis revealed that much of the complaints received by the NCC emanates from two distinct sectors, namely the general consumer goods industry, which relates to furniture, appliances, and the like, and from the motor industry. These two sectors account for approximately 80% of all complaints received by the NCC. The NCC is not able to deal with all consumer complaints on its own, as its key mandate, insofar as complaints are concerned, is to investigate prohibited conduct. Not every complaint can be investigated. To give effect to its mandate, it must work closely with other key stakeholders to promote the resolution of consumer complaints. The strategic framework 2012-2017 was to a large extent not quite aligned to the South African consumer policy prerogatives as espoused in the Consumer Protection Act. Moreover, the strategic annual performance and business plans were highly ambitious given the fact that the NCC is a public entity still in its infancy and with very limited resources, including the relevant skills. It was established that consumers are primarily interested in having their disputes resolved and in a very short space of time. Consumers are not really interested in businesses being punished for prohibited conduct or for unfair conduct. They are interested in having refunds, in getting exchanges for their goods, and so on. The NCC When I'm able to deliver as faith plans over the last financial year, which was 2012-2013, it would appear that the plans were based on an unrealistic budget. Moreover, the Honourable Minister of Trade and Industry, Dr. Rob Davis, recommended that the NCC formulate a strategy to deal with complaints handling, including the backlog. Also, to ensure that proper compliance notices are issued, and thirdly, to revise the strategic and annual performance plans. It's against this background, albeit brief, and the impossibility of performance that the NCC has revised its strategic and annual performance plans. I go on to deal with the revised approach. Whilst conciliation is a means of dealing with complaints, the constant opposition by business to this approach taken by the NCC, coupled with the threat of court action and limited jurisdiction in this regard, the NCC decided to, one, shift conciliations to the respective industry bodies through a process of accreditation of OMB schemes. And this is where expertise and capacity in such matters reside. Secondly, advise industry that the NCC will cease with conciliations incrementally until the conciliation mechanisms are fully operational. And thirdly, to approach the provincial consumer protection authorities to prepare to deal with consumer disputes that arise in their respective provinces. The intention of this approach is to ensure that the NCC is firstly adhering to the policy as powers in the CPA and no longer act beyond its powers, and secondly, to ensure that it uses its resources appropriately, and thirdly, to ensure that consumers do not approach the NCC as a form of first instance and thereby alleviating the complaints burden. In pursuance of its strategic mandate as enshrined in the Act, the vision of the Commission is to be the leading institution in consumer protection that is professional, responsive, and effective. The mission of the Commission is to promote compliance with the Consumer Protection Act through advocacy and enforcement in order to ensure fair business practice and to uphold the social and economic welfare of consumers. Values are common traits and attributes which guide the manner in which an organization will operate and relate with its stakeholders. They are intended to define and shape the culture of the Commission and guide how staff members interact both internally and with stakeholders. The Commission's value statements relate to professionalism and ethical conduct, efficiency and effectiveness, non-discrimination and fairness, responsiveness, accountability, transparency, to be people-focused, and teamwork. 14 weaknesses of the NCC have been highlighted by staff, and I shall deal with them individually. Inadequate information and communication technology systems. Now, this is being addressed. We are procuring a website. We have begun the process of procuring computers. The NCC has had severe problems with theft, and over 30 computers were stolen from the NCC over the last period of 5 months, 5 to 6 months. And there was a dispute with regard to the call center, which is also now being resolved, and we hope to procure a call center within the next 5 to 6 weeks. Inadequate human resources. This is a challenge. The NCC operates under quite a strained budget, and we are approaching the Department of Trade and Industry for additional funding. We've been asked to produce a document outlining all our requirements, which the department will take to the National Treasury in order to assist with the procuring of extra funds or obtaining extra additional funding. Internal and external communication. We have developed a communication strategy and in the process of finalizing that. Job descriptions of all positions are covered. This is being attended to. the lack of clear processes, the inaccessibility of the NCC to consumers, here again I refer to the contact center, and the location of the NCC currently. Skills and capacity building is a challenge for the NCC. We must remember that of the 132 persons on the approved establishment structure of the NCC, about 32 posts have been filled. The previous commissioner had appointed about 38 persons outside of the structure, and when I took over in September last year, the Minister for Continuity Purposes and Stability in the NCC confirmed the contracts of all staff at the NCC. So many of the staff had never previously worked in a consumer protection environment before, and there is a great need for training and capacity building. So there too we shall be approaching the department for additional assistance to train staff. The high workload, working in silos, this is being addressed on an ongoing basis. Leadership continuity, low work output, low staff morale. The low staff morale partly due to the that those 38 staff members, some of them have left, they have 32 or 34 left. Seems that they're not part of the structure, and this leads to low staff morale. The organization needs to undergo, we need to get an organizational design company in, we need to look at a bit of restructuring, also in line with our new revised strategic approach. Then differing interpretations of the app, and then poor reputation and negative publicity are the weaknesses that have been highlighted by staff. I'm not going to go through the next slide. It just outlines the roadmap followed to ensure the strategic alignment of all the processes. So I'm going to proceed to the next slide. We said that the strategic plan of the NCC is aligned with that of the DTI. The main objective of the DTI-CCRD is to create a fair regulatory environment that enables investment, trade, and enterprise development in an equitable and socially responsible manner, and promote a professional, competitive, and customer-focused working environment that ensures effective and efficient service delivery. And we also say that in line with the scripts of the Act, the Commission contributes to the DTI's growth path by freeing up increasing funding in the South African economy for investment or productive purposes through promoting compliance with the Consumer Protection Act and thereby curtailing incidences of prohibited business practice. Moreover, enforcing said Act consistently certainly is created, which adds confidence amongst business and suppliers. The strategic objectives were arrived at through careful assessment of the environment in which the Commission operates. Planning workshops were held, and it resulted in production of the strategic plan, which gathered up-to-date information about the organization's internal strengths and weaknesses and its external opportunities and threats. The analysis also considered political, economic, social, environmental, and technological aspects applicable to the Commission. Through this exercise, the NCC was able to refine and reshape the list of critical questions facing it, and thus defining the critical strategic tasks facing the Commission for the next 5 years. The following are the strategic objectives that will be pursued by the Commission over the next 5 years. The list is much longer in the previous strategic document. We have whittled it down to two. The first one is to promote compliance with the Consumer Protection Act. And number two, to be a well-governed and capacitated organization. Each objective is supported by specific key outputs, which are in turn supported by key performance indicators and targets, which will be detailed in the APP, the Annual Performance Plan, and Business Plan of the organization. Does the committee want me to take you through all the outputs and performance indicators? Okay. With regards to complaints registered and analyzed, we say that 50% of complaints received will be analyzed within 8 business days of receipt. Now, why do we say only 50%? Because we believe that 50%, the other 50%, would be referred either to the provinces or to the relevant industry associations and bodies, and the ombud schemes and so on. And then this increases to 60% and 70% over the following years. With regards to the resolution of complaints and the conclusion of complaints, we also talk about 50% of complaints resolved within 80 business days. And over the next 2 years, it reduces to 60 business days and 45 business days with 60% and 70% of complaints finalized in that period. Notices of non-referral. What are notices of non-referral? The Commission can issue a notice of non-referral where a complaint received is regarded as frivolous or vexatious, or where it does not disclose facts, which, if true, would not constitute a remedy in terms of the Act. Now, with regards to the notices of non-referral, we would also refer 50% within 20 business days, and then over the next 2 years, 60% of the 15 days, and 70% within 10 business days. Investigations. Reactive investigations, 90 will be initiated and concluded within each year. Proactive investigations, 9 will be conducted and concluded each year. We'll talk about industry codes recommended for accreditation in a timely manner. Industry codes, we are dependent on industry for the submission codes to the Commission for consideration for accreditation. So it depends entirely on industry to submit codes, and therefore we cannot give any specific numbers. What we are saying is that the turnaround time for the recommendation of codes to the minister from the date of the receipt of the codes will be 6 months. What happens from the 6 months is from the date of application to the date that the matter is submitted to the minister recommending either accreditation or not. The draft codes have to be published for comments. The comments need to be analyzed. There would have to be further consultation with industry and other interested parties. The code would have to be revised and thereafter submitted to Minister for possible accreditation. With regards to the policy document on accreditation, we're saying that there's no precedent for this. We haven't done this before. And I know the first study, this is accreditation for consumer protection groups. A first study was conducted and was found that no organization was ready for accreditation at the time. Research will have to be conducted. Stakeholders would have to be consulted, and we'd have to come up with some type of policy with regards to this. We said that 3 research studies will be conducted in the 3 following years. We said that 12 consumer awareness initiatives will be conducted over the 3 following years, 12 every year. Codes of practice. We are thinking of doing or preparing a code with regards to the plain language requirement. But this will obviously be dependent on budget. Outside assistance will have to be required, consultants will have to be procured, and depending on whether or not we do obtain the additional funding, then that will be undertaken. With regards to the implementation of the approved organizational structure, we're saying that the target for 2013-2014 is that we will fill 30% of all the positions within the approved establishment structure of the NDC. This grows to 50% over the next year and 90% over the following year. Now here again, we need to be very careful because we have to seriously consider our constrained budget. And we can only recruit as many staff as our budget allows. But we hope that we will achieve this 30% at least by the end of this year. With regard to the skills development plan and effective ICT services, we require consultants to assist with skills development plan and to assist with an ICT strategy. Stakeholder relations is very important. The NCC regards that as very important. There has been a problem in the past with negative perceptions of the NCC by outside stakeholders. The NCC has begun to mend that by having several meetings with a vast array of stakeholders. But the plan for 2013-2014 talks to biannual meetings with provinces, meetings with regulators, 5 industry meetings, the issuance of at least 1 media statement a month, the participation in the Africa Dialogue Conference. The Africa Dialogue Conference is an annual conference of African consumer protection regime. It was an initiative that was meant a few years ago with the assistance of the Federal Trade Commission of the United States of America and the South African government, the Department of Trade and Industry, prior to the commencement of the Consumer Protection Act. We were still administering the Unfair Business Practices Act at the Department of Trade and Industry, where we cooperated with the Federal Trade Commission of the United States, and the first dialogue was held in South Africa, where representatives of, I think, 8 or 9 African states were present. The dialogue now has a conference every year somewhere in Africa, and we hope to pursue this relationship, especially with a view to regional integration and so on. We also want to participate in Consumers International, which is an international NGO, and they have international conferences once every 3 years, but they communicate via the electronic media regularly. And also ICEFIN similarly. With regard to organizational risks being effectively managed, we talk to revising the risk register and strategy. Now this has been a problem in the National Consumer Commission. The National Consumer Commission did not have a proper risk register. We have recruited a risk manager who will hopefully be starting very, very soon. The recruitment process is almost complete. We also have employed an internal audit company, or company to perform the internal audit function, and they will also be commencing within the next week or so. With your permission, Chair, after the slide, I'd like to ask our CFO to take us through the actual annual budget for the financial year. But following the medium-term expenditure framework, the MTEF, Budget allocations for the 2013-2014 year were granted, adjusting the baseline upwards to cater for the effect of inflation. As a result, the budget allocation for 2013-2014 grew to 44.8 million from 41.5 million for the prior year. That is an increase of 8%. This allocation falls within the vote of the Department of Basic Industry. It must be noted that the DTI has indulged the NCC by providing 6.719 million in addition to the 41 million last year in order to enable the NCC to meet expenses incurred. In addition, funds being made available from donor funding, the SWE funds, to assist the NCC, especially with ICT requirements. The DTI and the NCC will be liaising, as I've said earlier, with one another on any additional budgetary requirements. This will happen very soon. The DTI's group CFO has requested a while ago a detailed proposal from the NCC on its financial needs so that the presentation can be made to Treasury for additional funding. In the interim, the NCC must live with what it has. I thank you, Chair, and I now ask the group, the CFO of the NCC, to take us through the financial year such a thing.
Thank you, Commissioner, and honourable members. I'd just like you to take you through the budget for 2012 to 2016. As indicated, this is a budget that has already been allocated, and we had to work based on what has been allocated. It must be indicated that it has been difficult given all the reasons that the Commission has already stated, and then see as to how we can prioritize and ensure that we basically have everything for NCC to be operational. The main challenge that will I'll come to that at the bottom, it will be the project cost, which is the main reason why the NCC is existing. All other costs, yes, are there to assist that the NCC operates well and get audited well and ensure that all the funds are spent accordingly. If we look at 2012-13, which is the previous financial year, 41 million has been allocated, and I do have the breakdown as to how this 41 million rent has to be consumed. The Commission has already indicated in the previous slides that the DTI has already given us more than the 41.5 million because we had other projects or other costs that we have to pay in addition to this 41.5 million. We have done the strategic plan, we have done the business plan, and then we sat with management, and then when we sat down, we basically wanted a realistic budget to be presented to Parliament. And by saying that is that historically we had all these funds that has been broken down in the E&E, and then with the current challenges that we sit in here based on the audit committee meetings that we had, and then with the meetings that we have internally, there were other costs that we were very aware and that we have to highlight and ensure that they are included in this revised strategic plan. And notably, those costs basically, some of the costs had to be reduced, not because we foresee the costs going down, but because of the main allocation, with the hope that we should be able to convince the DTI after the motivation from each division to allocate us more funds. And notably, the best cost drivers of this budget right through to 2016 are the employee costs. Because I think the NCC is employee-driven, and then, basically its services is employee-driven. And then one of the key items that have been highlighted as being one of the cost drivers is the accommodation, office accommodation, which is the lease at the building that we are at the moment. And the third one will be the professional fees, which is mainly consultant costs that we use from research, from finance, and other units. So to take you through all this 2012-13 to 2016, I'd just like to highlight the fact that after sitting down with management, the main worry the NCC was the program cost, which is the bottom transaction right at the end, at the bottom there. Because program cost basically is a tool that assists the NCC to go forward. If NCC has to do a lot of investigation, it has to come from the program cost from the relevant unit. And if NCC has to be fulfilling its mandate, basically the main important thing will be program cost. So I'll just like to take you through the main categories that I've mentioned here under the goods and services, which is administrative fees, which consists mainly of all the stationary posting and the cleaning services and security that we have, and the advertising mainly being advertising. Sometimes we have to publish some of the bulletin into the government gazette, and that's where the advertising comes in, and that's why you see that the figures going high and high. It's not necessarily advertising from recruitment, it's advertising from publishing some of the documents in the gazette. And well, as said, I'll just skip it. It's just mainly less than 5,000. That will be basically your in-house assets that are not of high value, like microwave and so on. Audit costs, you can see that it has increased and is increasing. And this is based on what the Auditor General has projected. And it also includes the internal audit fees, which previously we did not incorporate into our budget. And then we have bank charges, bazaars and training, and then catering, internal activities. Communications is mainly for the telephone costs, computer services, which mainly go for the emails of the NCC, and consultants as indicated, which basically is going down on a yearly basis. And after meeting the data in the new future, we definitely will be getting assistance from them, because every unit will present to the DGI as to and motivate as to why do we need more funds, like the research group as an example, because some of the activities we cannot do them internally and then we have to outsource them, like for example drafting the ICT strategy and then skills and development plan indicated by the commissioner. And internal and external entertainment is mainly the meetings that we have internally and externally. And as you can see, NCC is highly engaged now with the consumers, with the business. And included in that will be for the NCC as a whole, because as indicated by the commissioner in one of the witnesses, the low staff morale as well will assist by having team buildings, which is being included in this budget. These payments is for office accommodation. Legal fees is going down, and the reality is not that we anticipated to go down like that. It is because of the budget constraint, but we will have the motivation as well from the legal unit, basically stating as to why we need more funds above as to what has been presented here. Printing and publications, basically, yes, for the strategic plan to be printed, and then it's for business plan and so forth. And audit committee fees, which is another one, and it could be another shock to members probably. Mainly it's for audit committee members, you know. So we initially budgeted 90 grand and 90,000 per annum, but with the audit committee meetings that we have already had already, you know, the realistic fees, the figures indicated that for one audit committee member, the funds were very high, and then and we had to incorporate this to other years as we go on. Repairs and maintenance are for our own computers, furniture broken, and then the program cost, that's the only issue that basically will be left after considering all other transactions that are stated in here. So I've already indicated that the top three driving expenditures are compensation of employees, which amounts to 58%, professional fees 12%, and then office accommodation is 12%. And then this makes up 82% of the total spending, and that's only 18% being relatively variable. And then the project costs are however limited to 1.4 million rand, as indicated in the previous slide. At the moment, I'll allow the commissioner to continue the strategic risks. Thanks.
Thank you, Prabhu. Chair and honorable members, the NCC has a risk plan that is in the process of being approved. It has not been approved yet. The risks are being managed on an ongoing basis. I have included it in this document for the sake of completeness, but would prefer not to go through all the risks until the approval has been done. The management of risks will be embedded, however, in the processes of the NCC. If the committee wishes me to read through these risks, I can do so. But that's it. Thank you. The same goes for the next page, and that would then be the end of the presentation. Thank you.
All right, Commissioner, thanks a lot for the input. Can you turn off your mic, please? All right, honorable members, here's a presentation from the NCC. You can see that our baby is still struggling. So I'll take the list. Hill Lewis will be the first, followed by Honorable Albers, Honorable Van der Merwe, and Owen McIntosh. The last one will be Honorable Slough.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thanks a lot to the Commissioner and his team for the presentation. And thanks for always responding very quick and efficiently to all of the things that I sent through to you. You must have a special place in your inbox just for Gordon's correspondence. But thanks a lot for that. I appreciate it. I have a couple of questions, Commissioner. Firstly, on your revised approach, do I understand it correctly that you are phasing out conciliations as a general practice, and that you're going to move straight from the point of complaint to the investigation or to analysis, I think is what you call it, and then to the issuing of a compliance note. So no more conciliation. If that's the case, then I'm okay with that, because I understand the challenge that you have. But if that's not the case, I am concerned then that essentially the NCC is slowly but surely turning into a postbox for complaints that automatically get referred to other consumer protection bodies around the country, either in provinces or the ombuds people that you identify. So I'd like some clarity on that. When it comes to your strategic objectives, you said that you're going to register and analyze 50% of complaints within 8 business days. And you imagine that the other 50% will be referred. How do you know how to refer a case or not until it's been analyzed? Surely 100% of all complaints must be analyzed before you can determine whether they can be referred or not. So I'd just like some clarity on that. And then, when you say referred, refer to who at the moment? Because, as you've said, there's a lack, a dire lack of accredited consumer protection bodies other than yourselves. In that regard, the DTI, or there was recently an announcement which the DTI sent to all of us about the establishment of a consumer ombudsman, which for me is very good news because, I appreciate that you guys receive thousands of complaints, and it would be nice if there was a level before the NCC in the form of a consumer ombudsman. But try as I have, I haven't been able to contact that ombudsman, and I can find no contact details for their office online. I think it would be very useful for you, even if that ombudsman is not in any way formally connected to you, to publicize the details of where consumers can get in touch with that ombudsman, what their contact details are, all of the relevant details, so that some of that smaller level complaints, more simple to solve complaints, can be directed away from the NCC and to that ombudsman. Then, I did have another question, which escapes me right now, Chair. I'll come back for the second round.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to reiterate the previous comments that you do a lot of hard work, and I have my sympathy for the position that you're in and the complaints that's coming to you. I know that you're inundated and people are asking you to perform miracles. Having said that, you do have a very important mandate to fulfill, and I've always been concerned about the fact that you don't have enough budget. And I've asked this before, and I would like to ask again, what would be your ideal budget so that we can ask the minister to give that to you? we'll talk about the salaries of MPs later on as well. you're a very important body, and as you're being established and you're still in your infancy and you've had a lot of problems, I think that at the very least, the current government must look at your position more sympathetically in trying to put you in a much stronger position. But I know that you are overworked. You're being asked to solve problems from government service delivery to private service delivery problems. It's just a huge load to take. Also, if you could just clarify for me the balance that you're going to take. What will be the balance or percentage of your workload in terms of dealing with individual complaints and dealing with industry-wide problems that you will be tackling going forward? And then, Chair, I'm not sure if this is the appropriate moment. I spoke to Ms. Fabs, the Chair, yesterday about a problem that needs the attention of the NCC, and that is the problem regarding vacation clubs. That is now a growing concern, where people are being targeted, I almost say gullible groups of people. It might sound a little bit negative, but people being promised the heaven and earth in terms of vacations. And the move now is from the white baby boomers who've been focused on by this industry is now moving into the black up-and-coming market and trying to get those people to buy into products that they cannot actually use going forward. And I'd like to talk to you about that. And Ms. Fatt has indicated that it might become a priority as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I think we really, as this committee, ought to thank the Acting Commissioner and his staff for really stabilising this organisation. It went through a very difficult time, and I think some of the weaknesses you've identified also point to the difficulties that the staff have in terms of leadership issues, low output, and low staff morale. And I think the precise and the organized manner in which you've done your presentation really needs to be commended. I think some of the assurances that this committee would like to seek, though, are around the ICT stuff, because that was something that was very sharply raised with us over the years. It's identified as a weakness here, and it's in your plan to restore. But I think that is probably, if you're going to run an efficient organization on minimal staff, because you're only hoping to get 30% in the next year up to scratch, according to that figure, I think you need to have your ICT structures up and running. Unlike my colleague, Honourable Albert, I don't think we should ask you what your ideal budget is, because if you had to ask me what mine was, it depends how many Louis Vuitton bags you could buy in a month. You know, I'm thinking everyone must have an ideal budget. So that is the one concern, is the ICT structures and the way in which you are doing that, progressing on that. I think it's a very important area. Obviously, all the others that you've raised are important, but the one that worries me a little bit is the differing interpretations of the Act. Now, I just want assurance on that point that your staff are all on board with how you interpret the Act, because that would certainly create quite a lot of confusion and also be very detrimental to the way that you engage in your work. So I just want assurance on that area that that you are on top of that with regard to how the analyses and so on take place with cases that you do receive. Thank you.
Or Makatin, I know you respond.
Sorry, and my mic, that helps me too. What I want to say is I must tell you, since I arrived on this committee last year, I've sensed extreme pushiness in the DDI on the NCC. And it was quite clear that it was going badly. I actually think after reading this very good presentation and the background, it's actually a disgrace. We passed a law, a good law, and frankly, we don't expect DGI to produce a result like this. So basically what happened is the midwife to this new body which came out of the law was not successful. We've actually delivered a very unhappy situation. But it's quite clear that the department has been involved, and I remember Mr. Naidu came along and organized some extra money, which I'll talk about. But I just want to say good luck. You obviously, the DTI realizes that it cocked up here, to use a Putin term, by the way, terminology, not rude language. And I think it's good that they're trying to rescue it. I have a few direct questions, though. On page 3, slide 5, I found it astonishing that 80% of the complaints related to furniture, appliances in the motor industry. Now, to me, if you can establish some sort of connection there, we can deal with that quickly. But, and I'm sorry, I should know, approximately how many complaints, that 80%, I mean, what's the figure we're talking about? 65,000? 6,000? And when, could we have an indication? Then, next question is on page 4, 7. When you talk about, in the second bullet point, you will cease with conciliations incrementally until the conciliation mechanisms are operational. I'd like to get some idea, is incrementally going to be 20%, 30%, and when do you think the conciliation mechanisms will be operational? That interests me. And then the next question is on page 9, slide 17. Page 5 is the next question. In terms of your weaknesses that have been highlighted by staff. Mr. Chairman, we have found that there's an octopus in the DTI and its tentacles go all over. And that octopus is known as Nahal. And I wanted to ask Mr. Mohammed, is Nahal involved in the problems you have in dealing with the staff issues and them all resigning and leaving and so on? And also the fact that we suddenly had all those appointed confirmed by the minister. Page 9, did I was on? No, I'm sorry, I'm getting mixed up. Slide 9, I've done that. Page 9, slide 17. I do like this terminology. I call it discretion. It must be noted that the DTI had indulged the NCC. I mean, they were the midwife to the NCC, so they got it probably well saved their babies, but I like the word indulged, by providing 6.7 million in addition to the 41 million last year to enable. What I'd like to know is how is that dealt with administratively, Mr. Mohammed, in terms of the PFMA? I'm not sure that there's a word called indulged in the PFMA. Final question is, could I suggest, I mean, the annual budget that the CFO presented, I'm not sure if the CFO is a CFO or an acting CFO. We have so many Hollywood...
He's a full CFO.
I'm sure he's a good CFO. There are a lot of very good acting people in the civil service, but I'm sure many of them would like not to be acting, but to be permanent. But the use of this term consultants, there's a certain embarrassment about the word consultant. I myself don't think that's an embarrassment, because I think often it's a very sensible thing to use consultants. They come in and then they leave, they pay, it's sorted out. The trouble is if they are exploiting you. But maybe to avoid criticism, one should, instead of talking about consultants, talk about service providers. And then they can avoid that element. But thank you for taking us through the budget. Obviously, what's more interesting is how it's going to pan out at the end of the MTDF period. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Order, Mr. Lau.
Thanks, sir. Just like all my colleagues, we must thank the NCC for not having left the problems identified in the hands of God. Because those who are helped by God are those who try. So, I just want to quickly rush into three questions. One area is not so much of a question. It has an element of a question, but also an element of an advice. On page 5, I think you're talking here about getting into an environment where in the staff gives you 14 complaints. The first question is whether those complaints are genuine, or it's not whether they are genuine or not, but it's how do you deal with those questions as you go forward. Just taking a look at these questions, the majority of which to me can be joined together as weaknesses of communication and relationships. If you look at inadequate communication technology, the technology, inadequate human resource, internal and external communication, just as you start looking at that, you can see that they are linked into one direction, and you can go on and on. Most of them will lead to issues of communication. You know, when you talk about silos, you talk about all of those things. They are there because there are some serious weaknesses of communication. Then in your strategic plan, you are referring two areas only to consultants to help. That's skills development and ICT. And I think these two are linked to a number of others among those complaints. Why not, instead of spending in bits and pieces, doing one expenditure that would address all matters in this particular section that deals with communication and relationships? That would include the issues of skills development. Obviously, you need good skills because someone has got to do some kind of communication to these people as to what would be the right thing to do and not leave them like that. And they are inadequate because they don't have skills. You know, they are all linked one way or the other. And there are, well, other issues like low morale, which your CFO says is put up a budget of entertainment to pick up the morale through team building. I wish to be part of that entertainment, CFO. I'm just saying, take a look at that. See if it could not be able to be helpful. And I'm not saying that from an angle of imposing. On page 7, there is this question on the optional or voluntary submission, on compliance with the Consumer Act. You know, the second slide number 14, I think. The question is, if you say the industry codes, it's up to the industry to bring them so that you can then process accreditation. My question is, what if they don't bring them? Are we going to allow an environment where industries are operating without those codes? Or do we have, or does the ICC, the NCC, have teeth to be able to deal with those that undermine the need to be accredited, to have accredited codes. And if not, strategically, how do we think we can be able to deal with that issue going forward? Because it looks to me more like a gap. And I'm not sure how much power you have to handle that particular situation. I've dealt with the issue of consultants. On the budget, Mr. CFO, before you make some explanations, I had this question of how. How do you arrive at some of these figures? And as one reads them, you see big reductions, and you say, how are you saying the problems we have now will not be there next year? Or are we sure that we can be able to predict that the program costs that can take us 1.5 million this year would not be able, will be reduced to 340 million. Are we really sure that we would be able to cope with, or are we depending on moving in between and looking for additional funds? Are we sure really that when we talk about 7 million legal costs at the moment, reducing them to 5 million, these legal costs, no, but the legal costs are not really that bad. I think what is bad here is that's the legal fee. It's 2.5, 2.6, and then suddenly it goes down to 1 million. Because my view would be that the more the NCC gets stronger, the more for the beginning it will have to become worse. The situation will have to become worse before it gets better. And I do not think over a period of a year or two we shall have arrived at the time when it's already better. So that million rand, have it, I find. But remember me when we need additional funds. I am not sure that we get it there, but we can see these are the estimates we understand. And the issues of administrative costs, yeah, no, we are fine. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right, honourable members, I think that we have taken all your time for questioning. There will be no second round of questioning around this issue of the NCC. And then I think that in the next presentation, there will be a limitation of 3 questions per session. So we cannot have a deficiency, we are going to have 5. But what I'm going to have from the side of the chair is just a comment. The first comment is that we have a good presentation in front of us, which actually gives us a clear picture of what is happening in the NCC. I think that one is very good. Yeah. Because I think that as the policymakers here and the oversight committee, we must really help the situation as it is, so that we are able to take proper decisions. But before I hand over to the commissioner and his team, I'll still raise the question I raised last year. I said, here in South Africa, we are a non-racial country, of which we expect that the demographics of the country are reflected in the whatever institutions we are heading. So what I'd like to have is the question is, how representative is the organogram? I think that I asked that question last year. I don't see anything being captured here around that. Because really, as I said that, we are really a very fortunate country. Because we have our Caucasian friends, we have our African friends, we have everyone. So everyone must be there, so that really we pull together as a country. That one is very critical. So, my Caucasian friends, there is the... yeah, African Caucasian. But, it's very critical. But that one is said in the lifetime. But what is very critical here is that everyone must have a say within the country. I think that one is very important.
because we are building a non-racial, non-sexist democratic society. I think that all the response you must give us on a human resource strategy, how we are addressing that, because simply has not yet been addressed. Number two, I think that there's a marked improvement from the work which happened last year. The part which I like most is the issue of engaging with the industry. Because the nature of our constitution and the nature of our law is in such a way that in South Africa we must dialogue. That one is the bottom line. So I feel that it's very critical that the commission must not have adversarial relationships with the industry. They must go, when there are no complaints, go down there, have sessions with the auto industry, with the communication industry. I see that those guys are ones who are giving you an edit, whatever, or MTN, or Vodafone, whatever it might be. Have a strategic session with them and emphasize the importance of having heavy consumers in the country. Because if we are going to a country where the consumers are respected, the state of the country in the outside world is also going to be respected. I think those are the things that that's a good, really, it's a breakthrough on that solar card. Also, on the issue of, that one will go straight to the DTI. I'm very worried about the organogram. If during the current financial year, the target is to reach 80% of the organogram, then we are in a serious problem. We are in a very serious problem. I don't think that is really we can make this big law which raised so many expectations and then don't match it up with the required budget. Really, that's not a small, however small it might be, but if the target is only 30%, then we are in a serious trouble. I think that the DTI must come in here and tell us how they are going to help the commission to improve that. Also, the other aspect which is very important is the issue of proactive lenders. When you go to page 7, the number of proactive investigations is very good. Because you don't have to wait for the consumer to wait for the data. We know that with intelligence, I like the other commission which is going to present here. They are going to establish their research unit. They are going to establish the intelligence system so that they have the seed, what is happening in the whole environment. So this issue of proactive investigation is very good. That one is going to lower good. Because when you do it proactively, you are not having any people who are fighting, but you engage with the perpetrators beforehand, that red guys, fix your thing. In the future, your lawyer cost will go down because you've engaged the guys. I think it's a good improvement. But on the issue of the budget, I really concur with other rules, Albert. Really, if your target is 80%, then we have serious problems. I'll hand it over to you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair.
The DTI can respond if there's anything they have to respond to. Because I think that is something to do very hard. Also, apart from the stakeholders, also the union. The union is not an octopus. It's a very key stakeholder. Because if you have unhappy workers, you'll have a low staff morale. So that one must be a structured engagement. It's not around salary negotiations. Well, that's with the processes. Because I see that the other risk is the issue of the process within the commission itself. So that's what must be engaged with the union. The labor relations demands that we do that. You can compromise on that.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm going to have to rely on my team to respond to most of the questions. I think, Prudence, will you tackle all those relating to complaints and enforcement, please? Baz, will you deal with the interpretation ones? And how will you deal with all the budgetary ones, please? Maybe you can begin, Prudence, with the first. We'll go through all of them.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you, Commissioner. Dealing with the issue of complaints, I must say maybe before I deal with the direct questions related to the complaints, is that the Commission has had to revise its processes, its standard operating procedures, to make sure that we improve our communication with consumers. Over and above that, we have also developed several base documents to make sure that we do our processes and even our engagements with ombuds schemes, industry associations, and also with the provinces. I know that this presentation is at a very high level, so it does not have to the detailed work that is done in the background with regard to issues of referral and also issues of analysis of complaints and so on. But basically with regard to the question on the analysis of complaints, you are quite correct. In terms of the target, 50% of complaints to be analyzed within 8 business days. The intention is to analyze all the complaints, and you are quite correct in pointing out that before we can even refer, a complaint has to be analyzed. So I think what the commissioner was alluding to was with regard to the fact that after it has been analyzed, I think maybe we need to just correct that a bit. The analysis will have to be conducted first, and thereafter it will be determined whether or not it's a case for referral or a case for the commission to handle. So the process will go like that. So the 50% will talk to what we project we'll be able to analyze within the 8 business days. So the average would be the 8 business days, because some will be analyzed in an hour, some in a day, some in 5 days, and so on. But we also project that some might go beyond the 8 days. But what we are committing ourselves to is that at least 50% of the complaints that we receive will be analyzed within the 8 business days. Following that, it will follow the process of referral and the process of complaint handling. And I hope it answers the question of the analysis of complaints. With regard to the issue of phasing out conciliation, I think you're quite correct. We should be able to protect. However, I must also emphasize that because it's our new strategy, and from what we have assessed, the strategy is that we empower institutions that are recognized in terms of the CPA as complaint handling institutions, give them proper recognition, and thereafter make sure that they are able to help complaints. You must remember that facilitating amicable resolution of complaints is the responsibility of the Commission. So we will make sure, we will have to make sure that the complaints that are handled by the Commission, when we do refer them, the people who we refer the complaints to will be able to handle the complaints. We've developed a referral protocol with the provinces to agree on turnaround time. We've also had engagement with industry associations and ombuds schemes to agree on a process of complaints handling staff within the Commission, having meetings with industry associations, ombuds schemes and provinces on actual complaints. Thereafter, we give them a chance to try and resolve the complaint, but we test whether or not this complaint will be able to get attention before we can safely refer the matters to them. So I think maybe the issue of phasing out conciliation and also they're properly explained in the referral protocols with regard to how we intend working with other institutions that we will refer to. We will still be continuing with dealing with complaints in the time being. We will also incrementally refer complaints to institutions that the Commission is sure are capacitated to handle the complaints. And I think you're quite correct to say let us be able to do it incrementally, but also be able to quantify the time limit within which the conciliation will be faced. I think it's something that we will take back to the office to properly quantify and look at all the processes that we've developed to say in a year, in 2 years, in 3 years, and so on, we'll be able to phase it out completely if that ever happens, if all institutions are able to handle all the complaints. With regard to the issue of proactive, is it interesting? Let me see. I don't know if I'm missing something. Yes, with regard to percentage of complaints, motor industry, goods and services, I don't have the statistics with me currently to be able to tell you in terms of numbers, but it's quite correct that an enormous amount of complaints are with regard to motor industry and goods and services, fast-moving goods, where consumers complain about refunds and replacements and so on. And also, we have been working with the industry concerned to make sure that they are capacitated to be able to assist with complaint resolution, working together with the complaint handling staff of the Commission to make sure that consumers are getting the kind of redress that is expected in terms of the Consumer Protection Act. Yes, with regard to the vacation clubs, in terms of the current work that the Commission is doing now, the screening committee of the National Consumer Commission has recommended, I think about 8 investigation against various vacation clubs. And over and above the examples that the Honourable Member has given as the problems that consumers are facing with regard to vacation clubs, there are other several practices that as the Commission we've identified that they are going against the spirit of the Consumer Protection Act, and that is why those investigations will be conducted. The Commissioner, I believe, in the course of, I think yesterday, approved the certification of the investigations themselves into, I think, about 6 or 7 vacation clubs, if I'm not mistaken. I'll just have to get the number right. But we are looking at this issue and we're addressing it. We hope that within the coming 3-4 months, we will have the definite answers that we require. And so the assurance is given to the Honourable Members that the Commission is looking at the investigating various entities that provide the service of vacation clubs. Thank you.
Maybe I should take Honourable Member van der Merwe's question, if I can find them. With regard to the ICT challenges, I think I did indicate that we are in the process, and the reason why in the process is because there were serious challenges before with regards to the correct processes not being followed with regard to procurement, and we had problems of service providers and so on. But we've met with the Auditor General, who has indicated to us that we can do a deviation from ordinary processes, and we are therefore now going ahead with procuring a call center. And that is a serious problem, because the Commission needs to be available to consumers, and consumers need to be able to contact the Commission by dialing a number. And this is a frustration that most consumers face, because they can't seem to get through to the Commission because of the lack of an adequate call center. So that is being attended to as a matter of urgency now. With regards to the purchase of computers, we have purchased, I think, 40 computers. It's in the pipeline. It is being procured. The website development is also being done. We have purchased new servers. The Commission didn't even have valid licenses for IT, and we've now covered that. That happened both for the software, the Microsoft and the antivirus software and so on. So all that is happening, has happened and is happening. So within the next 6 or 8 weeks, I'm sure that the situation will improve dramatically with regard to the NCC. That with regard to interpretation.
Honourable Chair. Before I get to the interpretation issue, there was a question that was raised about the incremental approach. Now, the incremental approach that is being adopted by the NCC is dependent primarily on how quickly the OMBAT schemes can be accredited. It is expected that probably in the next few months, at least 2, OMBAT schemes may be accredited. Remember, it is important that whilst the NCC is not able or is prevented from conciliating in matters, consumers do need some redress. And on that basis, the Commission has agreed to continue assisting parties who are willing to get around the table and try and resolve matters, not necessarily in favor of consumers, but to ensure that some redress is provided until such timely mechanisms are underway. So that is, I think, a matter of months away in relation to the majority of complaints. With regard to the interpretation, there is no different interpretation from the NCC. When there's an interpretation by the NCC, it is something that is abided by the entire organization. The differences would come from industry, from other stakeholders. and that is, I think, what was referred to. That being said, bear in mind that the Consumer Protection Act is a brand new act. There is no precedent for the type of legislation that we are indeed dealing with. Largely, international consumer law needs to be relied upon in order to try and determine the interpretations or assist with interpretation. There's very little currently in our common law that can assist with that. So we still have, I think, a far way to go before certain interpretations will eventually be finalized. Perhaps the courts may assist in this regard going forward. Honourable Chair, on the issue of Nahau, Nahau is alive and well in the NCC. Initially, I think that was started early this year. Union activity is encouraged at the NCC as in all similar institutions. It is important that employees are able to have their rights and so forth protected. It is something that is an ongoing issue. There is no agreement as yet with Nahau. It is just, I think, the beginning of the discussions that have commenced. But yes, they do have a presence at the NCC, and I think any union, for that matter, is welcome to be present at the NCC.
Sorry, Dave, with regards to your question on the demographic, unfortunately the NCC situation has not changed from the previous time because no new appointments had been made. Appointments will be made in due course, and the report will be given to the next meeting, the Portfolio Committee. With regards to the questions or the suggestions around communication, those have been noted and will certainly be looked at by the Commission. I'm not sure if there are any further questions other than the CFO and related budget. Yeah, thank you.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Member Dalal did ask about the what industries don't have application for codes. Now, sir, in that regard, if evidence points to the fact that a code is required in a particular sector or industry, then the Act does make provision for the Minister to impose a code. And invariably what would happen is that discussions would take place between the NCC and the Minister and his staff, indicating that there is a need for this particular type of intervention and perhaps draft something for Minister to consider to be imposed for that sector or industry.
Thank you, Chair. The first question, I think, has been answered by the Commissioner relating to the ICT challenges. In a nutshell, basically, the procurement of servers and all other IT-related issues, the call center in progress, and that should be able to be resolved very soon. And what's the question of what is an ideal budget? With regards to that issue, the NCC has already engaged all the divisional heads to be able to come together so that they can come with what they think is ideal in their units. After that, we will be working together with the DTI based on what has been budgeted by the heads and supported by the evidence as to how those costs have been estimated, and then so that we can be able to engage with them and say that on top of what we have, this is how much we need in addition to what has been given to us. There was an issue of question about the consultants where it was stated that service providers has to we rather use the service providers instead of the consultant. I don't know if I got it right, but if it's the case, point noted, and yeah, we will use the word service providers. And the main question that was critical as well was relating to the program cost and how these figures have been calculated. There was a question that, for example, legal costs are going down and then the program costs are going down. Are we going to cope? And the answer is that we're not going to cope. The main reason why we have these meetings with all the divisions to be the ideal budget, is to be able to say this is what we have, and on top of what we have, this is more that is needed on top of what has been calculated. It doesn't mean that if the cost going down, it means that we don't foresee having more legal challenges. The issue here was driven by the fact that after considering other costs within the allocated budget, we couldn't stretch ourselves more than what has been provided. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, I'll give the department a chance to respond. I see the COO's hand is up.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Ministers. I think I just want to respond to Honourable McIntosh, just in terms of the role of DTI with regard to the NCC. Chair, I think the Minister has briefed this committee, I think, quite a few times, and I think in all his engagements he's been quite categoric that there are challenges. I don't think we've tried to hide any of those challenges from the committee. I think the Commission in his presentation has indicated the Minister has put a plan of action to look at the backlogs, to look at reviewing the compliance notices, to revise the strategies and the ADTs, because some of the targets that had initially been put out when we got into the detail and we looked at that, they're not realistic. I also just want to indicate that most of these issues are in the process of being addressed. And as we do when we incubate any particular agency, there's a DTI team we draw on from the DTI, you know, finance, HR, our marketing, our call center, and those individuals have been assisting and working with the NCC. I think initially the DTI looked at their call center and had then made the offer that we would then take quite a few of those calls. Even if you look at the DTI stats, initially at the inception of the NCC, our call volume spiked. Primarily, 80% of those calls related to NCC. So I think we've been dealing with that. I mean, the group CFO, I'm sure, would be talking to a lot of the finances because he's been intimately involved with the NCC. But I just want to also just indicate that I think the Minister has also indicated to the committee in last year that there are government processes that have to be followed in terms of finances. That we have to put submissions via the MTA process. And we have been doing that. I think the additional funds, the group CFO will talk to that, but that has also been made available from the suite funding the department has access to, and that's a part of the project conceptualization. So those funds have been budgeted for well in advance. However, before the DG can transfer funds, he needs to be ensured that the Section 38 of the PFMA in terms of the NCC having the appropriate systems in place. That has to be in place before he can transfer the funds. Otherwise, he can then be held liable for negligence in terms of how he's managing the funds. So that's the support that we've been providing in the background for the NCC. I just want to indicate that the Minister himself, we've advertised the commissioner post. The Minister will be, in terms of the Act, has come and seek the concurrence of the Portfolio Committee, and I think that is subject to his diary, but Sir Roger, I think, has indicated that will be happening within the next 2 weeks or so. So in terms of the leadership, I think we're confident that there would be stability in that. I think just in terms of the staff issues and the issue about Nihao, I do want to put on record that Nihao is a very... a good partner in terms of labor relations. And yes, I think within any employer relations, there are areas where of robust discussion. But I think Nihao had also raised from a staff concern that there were some staff concerns that needed to be looked at the NCC, and that's when the DTI got involved and also assisted. So if it wasn't for Nihao, we also wouldn't have been aware that there had been a number of people challenges that needed to be addressed. So the DG himself got involved, and the Minister was also... the Minister has gone to speak to the staff of the NCC twice, and has made certain commitments, and there's an action plan that's in place that is being addressed. So, Chair, I just wanted to also indicate that in terms of the new approach of the NCC, using these provisional structures, looking at the ombud scheme, that's the intention of the Act. Whereas I think previously all of those complaints were coming into the Commission, and the Commission was trying to resolve those on its own. Now I think the approach is correct in terms of looking at partnerships and working with the provinces. So Chair, I think I just wanted to indicate that that's the work that the DTI has been doing just to support the NCC. But the Minister would also come and talk about the commissioner process. Thank you, Chair.
All right. I'll give the group CFO a chance to respond. I won't have to know this. I think you can come with that. Okay. Give that answer.
So thank you very much, Chair. I just thought maybe I should just reflect on probably a year or two ago when the previous head of NCC came to this committee and presented a budget of 94 million rand over and above the 83 million rand that was allocated at that time. And the committee at that time requested that I meet with the NCC the following day to be able to analyze that budget and give feedback to the committee. And I just sent a letter to the committee to indicate at that time that NCC could not motivate the budget. And since then, they haven't been able to motivate a proper budget to the DGR. Now, let me just say the issues that have arisen at the NCC is not because of the lack of trying by the department. The department on numerous occasions has made staff and expertise available to assist the NCC. In fact, at the commencement of the NCC, the DGI wanted to incubate the NCC to run their finances, but the then head indicated, no, she's prepared to do it on her own because she's the accounting officer and she wants to take responsibility for the finances. But after a few months, the DGI established that the finances wasn't being run as well as we thought it should be run, and we put in processes whereby we only transferred money for expenses that were necessary. If you remember, the previous head came complaining to this committee that we put a commission under our administration. I think when we did that, we did it correctly, so on reflection now. And you'll see this budget, you'll see expenditure going down. There's reasons for that, because now there's proper accountability for the expenditure, and unnecessary litigation is not taking place, whatever it did previously. Now, unfortunately, the new commissioner or the acting commissioner took office in September last year, and that was almost the finalization of the MTEF period. And we do not have proper motivation for additional budgets to be submitted to National Treasury. But we're working quite closely. In fact, on a weekly basis, I engage with the NCC with respect to their requirements or any additional expertise they require. So we're in the process of finalizing the budget for the next MBA process. But let me say, if you need additional funds, the department will have to try and find within its own savings to be able to transfer funds. And while chatting about that, maybe I should talk about the 6 million rand, the 6.57 million rand. Now, with respect to agencies, you have a couple of opportunities to be able to transfer money to agencies. The first is through during the MDA process. The second is through violence during the year, where you can give additional funds. And the third is during the adjustment estimate. This 6.7 million rand was made available during the adjustment estimate process. It went through National Treasury, it went through Parliament. So it followed all of the proper processes with respect to that. We believe as a department, NCC requires additional budget, except that it's got to be properly motivated. And we're working with them to do that. Thank you.
I think that this brings us to an end of the first session which we are having here. We are going to break for the tea break of about 15 minutes. It's about 3 minutes to 11. So at around 12 minutes past 11, we must be back so that we can take the second commission. Thanks a lot for the input you have made, even the improvements you have made. They are noted, and then I think that they give hope that something is going to happen in the near future. Even the reasons for the shortcomings are clear. But then, as I said, the issue of the organogram has to be dealt with, motivated a little bit. So, thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you.
So on our midst here, we are having the Commissioner Advocate Ludin. You are welcome back to this committee. And then we are also, she's accompanied by the Senior Manager for Transitional Performance, Mayor Rehelda Williams.
That's okay.
Yeah. These are the two top ladies who are in front of us. I think the issue of gender balance is not questionable now. It's 100% overbalanced. It's 100% overbalanced. But I think that this is really interesting to have presentation from you guys, because there are people who are with the people in the field. So now and again, we are in this air conditions, ivory towers. So we need the people who take their hands as they go down there, so that we can take the proper decisions from your advice. So, honourable members, the meeting is in session now. I'll give the commissioner a chance to present her presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, honourable committee members.
before I start, I would like to just clarify something or confess something, perhaps is the better way of putting it. We did submit our APP and our strategy for tasing, but after further engagement with the Auditor General and with the National Treasury, we've made some adjustments both to the APP and to the strategy. So what we will be presenting today is the revised, in particular the revised key performance indicators and targets, and the Minister will be retabling them in Parliament on Monday. So what we will be tailing the revised targets today. And perhaps I can just give a little bit of background. I think the committee may be aware that there's a lot more scrutiny of KPIs and of actual performance of institutions as against the targets that were set. So we as an organization have spent quite a lot of time trying to understand what kind of targets should we be setting. And the Auditor General cautioned us to be quite conservative in those targets and to rather limit them. So what we are presenting is what we hope is a refined set of targets. But what we spend a lot of time trying to understand what are the key things that we think we should be held publicly accountable for in terms of service delivery primarily. And so that is what we will be presenting to you. I just want to apologize to the committee about any confusion that may exist about that. And before Rihalda starts just taking you through our strategy, I thought I would just give you a brief overview of where we are organizationally at the moment. We prepared a very short presentation because I think in the past we found that we presented performance and then a couple of weeks or months later we presented similar information again. So we didn't want to overload the committee, but we're happy to share any information. So very briefly, the last 2 years, the organization is almost exactly 2 years old now. We spent a lot of time doing preparatory work and reviewing the structure, reviewing the workings of the organization. And I think we feel very confident that this year we're going to see the benefits of all that work. There's some key things that are actually going to be starting as early as next month. So one of the projects we've been engaged in is e-filing on the intellectual property side. And it's been finally tested this week, and I think in the next couple of weeks it will be rolled out to all the users. So e-filing in the intellectual property area, which is a completely new thing for us, is going to be starting. We've also spent a lot of time, and we've mentioned the FNB project to the committee on numerous occasions over the past 18 months. Well, it is starting next month. It's officially being launched in the middle of the month of May. So the FNB project, maybe just to clarify again, is where essentially FNB will provide a service of registering a company at the same time as opening a business banking account for customers. And we're hoping our current process indicates that the maximum time should be in a day. It will be just for standard companies, for standard memorandum incorporation, and it won't include the name reservation. That is the second step in the process. But we're very excited because this is actually, from all the research we've done, nobody else in the world has done that. So this is a South African innovation, and we think that it's going to have quite a transformational impact. The other areas that we've been working on and that will come to fruition in the next couple of months are the structure of the organization. We spent a lot of time reviewing not just the structure but the functioning of the organization, aligning it strategically and reviewing the whole service delivery model. In the past and currently, we have a lot of our resources, in fact, in our front office. So what we want to do is move a lot of those resources into the back office and become a much more have less, in a sense, less face-to-face contact, but have a lot more telephonic contact. So there are other elements of our strategy that need to work. We're still going to have offices. We planned 3 offices around the country, one in Pretoria, not at our office at the where it is currently, but in another part of Sunnyside, one office in Soweto that we will be opening this year, and then we have a Cape Town office that we will also be reviewing. I think the purpose of our offices must be actually
to facilitate the electronic transaction, so to help people conduct a register online. And that's also a similar approach that FNB is taking in their ranches. It's very much an online strategy, but it's about helping people bridge the digital divide because we recognize that it still exists. We've also launched a fax service and a scan service, so we're receiving a lot of applications from all over the country by fax. It's working very well. There are a few internal issues we're sorting out, but all these things have had quite a big impact on our registration and the turnaround times on our registration. And then I think there are two more projects I wanted to just highlight. The one was data cleansing. We've talked about those in previous years. We had a very concerted effort this year to update our company's register to make sure that missing information is captured and that incorrect information is corrected. So we feel that we've made quite a bit of progress in terms of data, just the data integrity. We've initiated a project with SARS, and through SARS we will also have a much closer relationship with Home Affairs. So Home Affairs is the custodian of individual identities, and we are corporate identity, and together with SARS we think that we can achieve two things: greater verification and integrity in our information, but also better service, more integrated service. So the last issue that I would just raise is the call center approach. I know you know we've talked about the Swedish model, and we talked about it last year. We were hoping to be able to roll it out in January. We didn't have the licenses, all the licenses that we needed, the call center licenses, and we only received them at the end of March. We spent April updating the technology issues, and we already started with it, but we think really in May it will start taking off. So those are the key things actually that have had quite a long lead time for the organization, but we feel very confident that all that preparatory work will really enable us to deliver the key things this year. So I'm going to hand over to Rihelda to take you through the strategy, and then I will just come in a bit later.
Good morning, everybody. I think our commissioner touched basically on our strategy for the plan, so I'll just do the boring but the theoretical part of our strategy. In essence, what we did in this year planning, or the planning last year for this financial year, was to take stock of where we were and to update, because our strategy document itself, or the strategy of the organization, is not a short-term intervention, it's rather a medium-term intervention. So in essence, what stayed the same was our policy context. We saw mandated by the DTI and the documents that emanate from the DTI, IPEP and GST's documents, the Department of Arts and Culture, excuse me. Yes, science and technology, arts and culture, and so forth. So that was still the basis for the planning for this year. Our vision, our mission, that stayed the same, that we still want to play an active role in the economy of the country, that we want to have greater impact. And so none of that would have changed. You would have seen, and even the revised document, you will see that none of that has changed. What we did do, and that what we agreed with the minister early this year, was that we will have four strategic focus areas. And these areas are around improving the reliability and the integrity of the information on our database, to improve our relevance and our value to the customers, to our customers. At the time, we said that we want to improve compliance with the law that we administer. But when we unpack that a bit further, we realize that is actually a subset of our relevance and the value that we offer our customers. Instead, and you'll see in the revised document that we'll table soon, we will look at the ease of transacting with us. And a number of projects, namely the ones that the Commissioner had outlined, speak to ease of transacting with us. And I think that is perhaps the area that the committee in the past has highlighted as key for the public as well. Then lastly, we want to demonstrate our economic impact. And in our second goal, the one around innovation and creativity, our efforts actually are aimed at demonstrating our economic impact. Like I said, our vision is still the same, that we want to play a lead role in formal economic participation. Our mission is still It's around four areas that we want to provide easy services, that we might want to maintain and disclose accurate, reliable, credible information. You will also see there's a threat between our mission as an organization and the strategic priorities that we've identified, because we want to ensure the alignment throughout the organization. And in order to achieve our desired state, our vision, we have to have certain behaviors that support it. And we've identified in the past financial year already, in the previous strategy that was stable, five key values for the organization. Namely, passion for service. Somebody had asked yesterday when we did a similar presentation, what does that mean? If it's a very subjective, that if a member of the public feels that he didn't get that passion for service, what is the recourse? And how do we measure passion for service? Is it a smile, or is it actually the desired transaction that has been completed within a specific time frame? So that is... So secondly, integrity. I think that it's across all organizations that we always strive to have integrity in what we do. And you all would have noticed that in our focus area, there's emphasis on integrity of our registers, empowerment of our staff, and I think also through information sharing with the public, with our customers. And we want to be accountable as an organization, and lastly, collaboration. I think over the past 2 years, and in the year to come, we've placed a lot of emphasis on collaboration. Internally, we've had a number of projects where we've had internal collaboration among different divisions, breaking down silos within the organization, as well as externally, where we partner with other organizations in both the corporate space as well as the IT environment, where we look at other IT agencies such as TIA and NACMO, where we share collaboration efforts with them, and then, of course, in the banking sector. I must clarify, because we always get questions around the FNB collaboration, why FNB and not other banks. At this point, it's a pilot, and I think when we presented in December, we said that we realized that other banks, such as Standard Bank, also had an advertising campaign around annual return compliance. So the idea is to involve all banks. For now, the company registration component that will be done through FNB is just through FNB, because we have to do the testing and thorough testing thereof before we can invite other banks to collaborate around that. But the invitation is open to other banks. We have met with NetBank, with Standard Bank, and with APSA, extending the invitation to them. They seem quite keen, and I think the issue for them currently is that they have to wrap their minds around the development of systems that can plug into what we have in place. Our strategic goals for the remaining period for the medium term remain the same. It's around three areas: improving the competitiveness of the economy, where we look at enhancing the reputation of businesses and the business environment to contribute to a knowledge-based economy, and here we're talking specifically around the creative and innovative industries. And then thirdly, to promote broader formal economic participation by enhancing our service delivery. You will note that in the breakdown of our goals and our objectives, and particularly the KPIs, our KPIs that we will table in the revised APP and strat plan around service delivery issues, because we have, as the Commissioner had said, the AG had advised us to focus on service delivery issues that are measurable and that the public have an interest in. In the past year, our KPIs were very outcomes-oriented, and the issue with outcomes-oriented goals and KPIs and so forth is that AG finds it very hard to audit on a year-on-year basis. And the advice basically was bring you down to be more operational and to what is within your control. So I think what I, in an implicit way, am trying to say is that our audit report on performance information might reflect badly, might indicate that we're not particularly smart or applied a smart criteria, but it's because we had looked at a longer-term impact indicator in the past financial year. The current financial year might be easier for them to conduct audits because it is operationally focused. What we've done in 2012-13 was to publish a set of service delivery standards, 38 of our core services, that's on the website. For what the service delivery standards do, it gives certainty, namely that if what we have seen in company registrations, for example, is that it can take a maximum of 25 days to do a manual company registration. We're in the process of updating the standards to say, for example, that it can take a maximum of 1 day to do an electronic company registration, provided that there's funds in the customer's account and that all documents are submitted, are complete and submitted. The provides that certainty, and I think that is what the public wants, that the customers want. Similarly, for cooperatives and others, we have in the past year looked at monitoring the service stands through an order process. It wasn't entirely successful. We're looking at new ways of doing that in the year that comes. But what we did in the IPP was to extract the key service delivery standards, namely company registration, cooperative registration, application for IP products, and also some around the call center answer rate and so. In goal 2, it's basically the same, where we look at service delivery standards for IP products, where we just look at the applications for patent applications, design applications, and copyright in films, where we look at a specific service delivery standard that we've published and to meet that service delivery standard. The idea overall, except for in goal 3, where we look at call answer rate, is to have at least 85% of the service delivery standard met over any period of time. And the third goal, which deals with service delivery and access, what we strive to do is to improve our call answer rate. The idea is to move from the current 28% to 50% in the financial year, and in the medium term to move that up to 90% of calls answered. Secondly, we want our website available at least 90% of the time on a 24/7 basis. There are dependencies that we're working on, and then we also strive to, in the past financial year, our target was to have 124% of our expenditure covered by operating and through our operating budget and our surplus funding, as well as our surplus budget. But in the coming financial year, we look at having a maximum amount covered by our operating budget. Then one area that we still feel is important to look at is to have positive or neutral media coverage in the mainstream media. We considered social media as an indicator as well, but that is very difficult to measure. One can just informally look at the trends and so, but it's very hard to say that to assign a percentage to positive or neutral media coverage on Facebook, Twitter, etc. This is just a breakdown of what we aim to do. Namely, that manual company registrations, we had 95% was our estimated performance of meeting the service delivery standard in the past financial year. We want to 95%, I must just qualify, is on the sample that's been audited, and it might not give an accurate reflection of what we've done. The samples consisted of 100 files per audit, and we have registered 200,000 companies, and about 66 to 70% of those were online. So whatever the calculation would be on 200,000, a third of those would have been manual, and all of those we audited 100. That gave that indicator figure of 95%. We think it's more realistic to say 25% will be met, or the service delivery standard will be met. For electronic transactions, one working day we're working towards. The last audit reports indicated that we can actually do that. In cooperatives, we battled with volumes over the last year, but we're still very positive that we would be able to meet the service delivery standard 85% of the time. Trademarks, most of the service delivery standards that we've identified, we hope to achieve it with 85% of the time. Same goes for investigations completed within the published service standard. There is a problem with the estimated performance that we've reflected on here, 53%. It's not right. What happened was that we ordered the 10 files. All those files, 4 were in the service delivery standard, 1 was queried, and 5 did not exceed yet, but there was a misunderstanding between the business and the auditors of what the process entails, from when it goes from a complaint to a formal investigation. So that needs to be looked at before we submit it to the Roach for tailing. One key area that we've identified around the strategic focus area that deals with the second strategic focus area of, or the first one, the reliability and integrity of our information and so forth, is annual return compliance. So there will be an emphasis on annual return compliance. We think we had 70% compliance in the past year. We want to push it up to 75%, and in the following financial year to 80 and 85 in the outer year. In terms of patent designs and copyrighting films, we want to achieve 85% of our service delivery standard in the year, and in the next year 90%. And then lastly, I think the one that we all have a key interest in is our website availability. When I was presenting to a group of people yesterday, they said, no, this can't be right that you want your website to be available 90% of the time, because 4 out of 5 times when I log on, it's not available. And then when I phone you, you don't answer your call, so you can't see that you're actually doing something about it. But the reality is that we're doing something about it, and our aim is by the end of the financial year we should be in a position to say that it was available 90% of the time on a 24/7 basis, and our calls should have been answered through this model that the Commission explained that we introduced. We have more volunteers in the organization answering calls for a set period. I think in December the Commission explained that the model that we adopted is that we have volunteers in the organization, and we have declared 9 to 11 a no-hitting zone where we all focus on all the volunteers. We've identified 70 volunteers, about 70 volunteers, who will be answering calls. It's been partially implemented. Some of the volunteers have received training and the software already, and the commissioner did a calculation. If all of the volunteers answer 5 calls within an hour, then we can push up our call answer rate to 80%. So that is something that we hope to overachieve on that particular target. I've mentioned the fact that we hope to have most of our expenses covered by our operating budget, and that we saw in the past financial year media coverage was mostly neutral, and we hope to maintain that. For over the next year, what we hope to do with our online facilities or our electronic facilities is to still have most of our company applications through a hybrid system that we have introduced. And then, as the Commissioner had mentioned, for IP, we are introducing a filing system, an e-filing system for all IP products in this financial year. We were rather conservative with our estimates on the uptake of those products, 30%, because we don't know. We must first see what the uptake will be and if there should be any teething problems that we can refine. And in the next financial year, we think that we would have half of our applications through the electronic filing system that we introduce. Registration figures, these aren't performance indicators, but merely projections on what we've seen over the past years. We have projected about 22,000 last year, and I think that is what we had for cooperative registrations. We think that the number will continue to increase in this financial year to 31,500. With company registrations, we had projected 200,000, but I think we are at 220,000. It might be a little more, a little less. We have projected 207,000. Trademark registrations, I think we had a record number last year of 33,000, and we're projecting that will increase to 37,000. Patent applications, it's just based on trends over the past years, that it will increase to 7,000. So local filings remains low. I know Honourable James has a particular interest in that. Design applications, somehow the local filings exceed the international filings. We just got the statistics for the annual report, and I think it is about 54% or so, but we'll reflect that when we label our annual report later this year. Films, the local filings still remain low at about, for the past financial year, it was about 20% overall, so we were rather conservative in our estimates there as well. I will ask the Commissioner to take us through our budget, because I'm not a budget person. I think there's more detail in the actual strategy document. And I want to qualify the budget up front. We've been engaging with Treasury, National Treasury, about a 10-year projection and a sustainability model framework for the organization. And we've, in fact, revised some of these budget estimates down. But we haven't reconciled it with the E&E figures at this stage. So we don't, we're presenting what the figures that are in the strategy at present. But I just wanted to highlight the committee that maybe that possibly during the course of the year, when we have agreement with Treasury, there may be some adjustment to this figure. We are a fully self-funding organization, so there's no appropriation from the national budget for us. And our concern has been understanding exactly how we use the surplus that we have versus operating expenditure. And that's what the engagement with Treasury has been about. So I think there will be quite an increase this year in terms of our expenditure as we implement our new structure and as we are able to recruit staff. We've had an agreement with organized labor that while we go through this transition period and the organizational transformation, that we will not hire any permanent staff. So we now know we are at the tail end of our discussions with Treasury about the structure, so we have a good sense now of what the number is that we will reach agreement on, the staff number, and that will give us an indication of what the recruitment will be for the year. So essentially, what we expect is that these numbers will be slightly lower, but that we will continue, our budget is consists primarily, of course, of staff expenditure. We're a service delivery organization, and that's our main cost. We've reduced operating expenditure quite substantially. We're actually quite efficient. And then we intend to spend about 30 million, 35 million on IT in the current financial year. And we have a modernization budget as an organization. We're going to be spending we'll be spending 20 million on the intellectual property budget to enhance the intellectual property system this year. We're not going to have a major expenditure on the company side because what we've been doing is in fact refining our existing capacity. We found that we in fact have probably quite a lot of spare capacity in terms of service. We're refining what we have and stabilizing what we have. It's quite critical for us to be able to achieve the 1-year turnaround time that we want to have on company registration this year. And we will be refining the strategy, the ICT strategy, for the next. And I think what we'll probably do is do our modernization over a 5-year period, incrementally, because what we found is that a big bang approach doesn't work for us as an organization. And that, in fact, what's very important is we've planned for we've got a 3-year contract in place with the service provider for the current system, so that we have the stability of that. And then in parallel, we will start developing the modules of a new approach. So essentially, our expenditure will be steady, and we will be incrementally over the next 5 years spending on modernization. We've also taken out, and we're negotiating with DTI about this at the moment. We've in the past talked about moving to a new building. What we would like to do is, in fact, stay where we are and build our own building because it's quite important for the sustainability of the organization. We have a surplus and we can use it for that purpose, but we don't want to spend money on fancy accommodation, but I can see Jody smiling, and it's not agreed with DTI yet. So I think that's all I would like to say about the budget. So maybe if I can just want to summarise again, what we've done as an organisation is spent a lot of time on putting the foundation in place, and all the key initiatives are actually coming on stream next month and the months thereafter. So we think as an organization you'll see quite different delivery. The APT and the service delivery target, we've modeled this as well on what the UK reports to Parliament in terms of their public, they call them public targets. So we think that we should be accountable to these service delivery issues. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner, and your team, or your partner, Ms. Williams. All right. Honourable members, here's a presentation coming from the Commission. It is one of the critical institutions in the country. I think that is by the fact that the Treasurer had to advise them to revise down their targets and their budget. It shows that they are still toddlers. So we must treat them as such. But we must expect them to run quickly, which means that we must give them more milk so that their bones can be stronger. So now it is an opportunity for you members to raise questions. I'll appeal that let us please go straight to the questions. Three questions per member, because I mean, Honorable Fanamer, Honorable Makitosh, and then Honorable Professor.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation. I think you must always remember, this is the prelude to my question, three more questions, is that we must make it easier for business to register the businesses. I will never forget that. I mean, that is the point. My anxiety is that the figures look very nice, but the one person whose call was dropped is 100% wrong. So I think I don't agree with the Auditor General. You've got to have targets that are realistic, but that will achieve that. But with a guy, we often hear the story, the guy phoned five times and only got through once out of the four. He's the person or she that we want to fix. I don't think we must forget that. I also just want to say one little thing, that there is a superstition amongst CEOs in big corporates. The minute they buy and build a new corporate headquarters, they lose their job. So you better be careful.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation, ladies. Much appreciated, and good ones too. My colleague, Honourable Fundamental, dealt with the one issue I wanted to point out. I do want to say I was really excited to see on page 10 your mention of volunteers and the use of volunteers, because to me that shows there's an esprit de corps, a morale, a keenness in the department. And I mean, that's the way we say, sure, bow ons a nasi. If people are prepared to volunteer, give their time, and try to help to push the wagon along, as it were. I have one or two questions. One lacuna, I know it's not here yet, but on revisit, no trust. And perhaps you could tell us what your plans are, maybe when you're in your new building, to get trusts into the identity system. Because I think you're right, our home affairs, our national identity, and you are in a sense our business identity setup. The other question I wanted to ask, everybody in the smaller companies, and I am in an SMME as it were, we are very busy dealing with our auditors getting MOAs, the new memorandum and articles, and we've got to meet terrible deadlines and everything. There's no mention of that in here, but maybe I'm misunderstanding it. And then I don't quite understand the distinction between filing and registration. I mean, I'm doing an electronic filing of a registration. Could you just help me there to understand that? And then on page 2, you talk very quickly that you, and it's a very important part from a government perspective, and let me hasten to add, you guys are in a wonderful place because you don't need any taxpayers' money. You're actually self-financed, and I mean, let's never forget that. It's wonderful that you do that. But what I wanted to find out, you talk about collaboration under CIPC values. How do you collaborate? I mean, is there a little committee with science and technology, arts and culture, agriculture and economic development? If you could just perhaps share that with us. And then on page 7, that brought in that same thing, replying to these memorandums and articles. Page 8, quickly. Oh, yeah. I want to ask you also, smartphones. And, I mean, everybody's on a smartphone portal. I'm not talking about Facebook. I mean, my the guy herds my sheep, I've got to tell him, stop, get off your Facebook now, and do your count your sheep. And everybody is on your smartphone. So, but is, are you guys applying it? I know you mentioned Mr. Twitter. Page what I don't understand is annual return compliance is only 70%. Is that done with filing or registration? And my last question, which will be a relief to Mr. James, who is obviously pregnant with a question, is how many, you can see I'm not a genderist, Mr. Chairman, how many volunteers, you said 70, but how do you organize it? Are they completely free? Or do they get a free cup of coffee in the cafeteria? Is it simply pro bono in the national interest kind of volunteerism? Thank you.
Jim.
Thank you. My colleague has the unique ability to tell half his life story when he's asking a question. And his son Tom as well. I had two questions. The first is the Honourable Funder Malvis' comment about ease of business registration is whether you have a project to simplify registration across platforms, because there's a number of forms to be completed, right? There's one for SARS, there's one for this, there's unemployment insurance and so on. And part of the story of easing registration is to have one-stop shop. So I want to, if you can tell us whether you're participating in a project like that. The second is the company registration numbers are very interesting. I think what would be also interesting is the company deregistration numbers to see what the level of churn is in terms of companies. If you have those numbers, I'd like to hear what they are.
Thank you, members. What I said, would also like to raise the issue of the business rescue schemes, which are expected to be tackled by. I know that before there were challenges. What is the status quo as we're speaking now? And number two is the issue of that certificate, which you indicated that it will cover the issue of BEE compliance, whatever it might be. I think I'll turn it up about honorable gender said. But will that also go to cover the issues of labor department? Because you know, when you go to labor, there are also some sort of compliances which they have to undertake. And then the third part, well, I think is still critical. Even if you are self-funded, it's still the taxpayer's money. I think that one must be the principle we must move with, that the way we treat it, you cannot treat it as a private kitty for the commission. It's still the taxpayer's money, which must be treated with respect. But what is very important really is to appreciate the issue of the way you have improved the work in particular. Just like South Africa now is being by the IMF, by the World Bank, said that is number 35 on the scale of ease of doing business. It was number 10 on the issue of protection of the investors. I think those are the stories which you must tell regularly, unlike the challenges which you are having. But those good stories must be told, so that the people must know that there's something right we're doing in this country. So you can fire on the questions if you have.
Thank you, Chair. I will answer some of the questions, and I think there's some that Rialda is better placed to answer. Let me just start by noting and concurring with the Honourable Falamava. I mean, ideally, we should answer every call. I think there's no question about it. I think we just have to be realistic about what we will be able to achieve. And I think there's no question for us that that's what we must achieve. You know, it's just not getting, these things just unfortunately don't happen overnight. It's about changing organizational cultures. It's about changing the way organizations function. But we are hopeful that we will outperform, not underperform, in the financial year, and that's what our goal will be. In terms of trusts, the issue that the Honourable McIntosh raised, In this project with ours, and perhaps I can just talk about it more broadly, there's been a project between Stats SA and SARS and CIPC and I think DEI and National Treasury were involved as well for quite a long time. And I think over the years, what Project Aim to Achieve has changed. We have been meeting very regularly with SARS for the last year, in fact, for the last 6 months, probably almost on a weekly basis. And we've really clarified now what we would like to achieve. So now what we need to do is develop the concrete project plans, and it's probably going to take us 18 months. That's our experience with, for example, the FNE project to really achieve, to bring it to fruition and to have concrete delivery rather than a plan. So what that project involves is, SARS is quite keen on bringing trust into the broader framework. So the broader framework, the broader collaboration framework that we envisage involves the Department of Home Affairs, ourselves, the Master of the Courts, who's responsible for trusts, and then, of course, SARS. And the idea is that we have heartbeat links between the different institutions, that we exchange information, we exchange data, we can verify each other's information, and we also provide not necessarily a one-stop shop, but an integrated service from different points. So one of the things we have been talking to SARS about is them, in fact, registering companies when they register you for that, if that's what you want, and they have agreed to do that. Now it's up to us to develop the ID systems to do it. Similarly, we currently do pass on information to SARS, and then we receive tax numbers from SARS, but what we will do is also allow, develop our system in such a way that you can then continue to register for VAT or any other registration. SARS, in fact, administers UIF and a lot of other workmen's compensation, a lot of other requirements. So what we'll do is we'll try and roll this out incrementally. And once we have a success, then it'll be easier to bring in on board others. So we think that this project will, what it will achieve is greater compliance maybe and greater information verification. We've had engagements with the UK authority. We've got somebody here at the moment from the UK. And their experience has been, even though one of the things we've been talking to SARS about is an integrated annual return filing, so that you can file with us and with SARS, and you can file your financials once. But in the UK, they've implemented something similar in the UK, and the uptake is actually very low. So we'll need to see. What we need to do is make it available to people. And so we think in terms of the ease of transacting with us, the critical issues are obviously making it easier to transact with us, at the IPC, but then also to make it easier to transact across government in relevant areas. So that is a project that's very concrete and clear, but it will probably take about 18 months for us to implement. The issue about the MOI for smaller companies, there's a lot of pressure, I think, on smaller companies who want to contract out of the audit requirement to file with us by the end of April. But you can contract out of that at any point in time. I think it's just that it was free of charge until the end of April, and I think there's a lot of companies out there that are trying to make a lot of money out of pushing people to file with us. We've gone through a system. We've seen an increase in volumes on memorandum of incorporation, and we deal with a lot of issues. So we deal with revisions, for example, removal of the audit requirements, but also the share capital updates, or changes to names. They are all dealt with in one stream of work. And so what we don't want to do is overburden it. And so what we're going to do is separate the standard MOI changes from the more specialized ones. And we'll just issue a notice to the public to say that as long as you file with us, you're fine, it will be recognized that your date of filing will be the effective date, but we're probably going to take 6 months to process it. So the public isn't prejudiced in terms of filing, and we can create a predictable environment. Rialda is going to talk about collaboration and smartphones. I just quickly want to talk about the difference between filing and registration.
you file an electronic company registration application with us, but then there's a validation that occurs. So it's only once it's validated and approved that it's registered. That's the distinction. And then maybe, Rialda, can you talk about the collaboration, smartphones, and the volunteers?
Thank you. Let me start with the volunteer program. What we, the leadership of the organizations extended an invitation to all employees to participate in a program to reduce the unanswered calls, to be more responsive. In December, it was after a benchmark with Sweden, where we realized that they've got about 250 or so volunteering in that registry. And our aim was also to get 200 or at least 200 volunteers. 70 people have come forward, including the commissioner, to answer calls. And what it means is that your other deliverables don't suffer as a result of you answering calls from 9 to 11 every day. Like we have said that it's not fully rolled out as yet. There's no additional incentive for such individuals. What we intend to reward them is to perhaps issue a certificate to, it is in the interest actually of collaboration internally, and that is one of the, one example of a project where the organization comes together to deliver on a joint goal. Then collaboration in general, the, we have met with the model, we haven't documented as yet a collaboration model for the organization, but basically we look at benefits for all concerned, particularly our customer. If we look at the SMB project, for example, the customer is the one that will benefit most. For many years, people have spoken about our accessibility. The banks are accessible. They are almost in every town. So it is easy for the customer to go to a bank. And with this particular model, where we look at web server development, it might not even be it might not even be a requirement for the customer to go to a bank, but a banking employee or the bank employee could go out with a mobile device and assist the customer in registering a company, regardless of where the customer is. The benefit for us in that particular collaboration model is that the banks are required to do upfront identity verification, and that's what we will get, and also experience footprint for us. And the benefit for the bank, of course, is that the bank, the companies that it will register will be in 1 to 4 bank account, and then it will be a seamless process for them. But at this stage, the bank is more interested in a voluntary compliance element, namely that if their customers comply with annual returns, then the customer is very, as an entity, very unlikely to be deregistered, and then it becomes less of a liability to the bank. Because if the customer is, or the entity is deregistered, the bank must freeze the assets, and it's just a big cost issue for him. Collaboration takes place in other areas, such as Nakontia as well, but what we want to roll out, or what we want to document as our collaboration model with external parties, is what is in it for the customer, what is in it for us as a public entity, and then lastly, then we look at the benefit for the entity that, or the organization with whom we collaborate. And it must be at no additional cost to the customer. It is all aimed at making doing transactions with CIPC easier. That's basically it. Oh, smartphones. I can't remember the exact stats now from the census last year, but quite a high number or high percentage of South Africans have smartphones. And we think that we can do much more with smartphones in the government space than what we're currently doing. About a year ago, we had one of our employees do some mystery shopping through when we started with the collaboration efforts with banks. And within a 24-hour period, that lady managed to register a company, a simple standard MOI, by simply using her smartphone. She took a picture of her ID and she sent it through. She took a copy of the registration forms, she sent it through. And whatever was required through her smartphone, 24 hours later, a shelf company warehouse that collaborated with a bank issued her with a registration certificate. So we think that we can actually bridge the digital divide through increased use of smartphones.
Let me just talk about annual return compliance. There are two parts of annual return compliance. The first is that you need to file your annual return with us. The second part is, of course, that you need to pay the requisite fee. We spent quite a lot of time developing a debtor management system so that we can understand who is due at what point and that we can really monitor who hasn't paid. The 70% that we estimate at the moment includes companies that should be deregistered. So we don't have the most accurate reflection of the, you know, of annual return compliance at this stage. We have deregistered, in January we deregistered about 110,000 companies, NCCs, and we will be deregistering another 300,000 by June. These are all entities that have basically been delinquent since May 2011, so over the last 2 years. So maybe to also answer Honourable James, in terms of deregistration, we don't have accurate numbers of deregistration in terms of not voluntary deregistration, but deregistration in general, because it's not done on a continuous basis at the moment. So what we are doing is we will be dealing with this last bulk deregistration, then we will be deregistering on a monthly basis. So we don't have accurate figures about that at the moment. I think I could get the liquidation and voluntary deregistration figures, because I can't remember them off the top of my head. But I don't think that our numbers in that area are accurate at the moment. I mean, it's voluntary. So this is going to be a major push for us this year. We're going to continue with this project, which again has been an 18-month project in the organization. Started with data cleansing. We've also shared data with SARS, so we're comparing our databases, and so we think that we need to have a lot more accurate data before we can really talk about company deregistration on an ongoing basis. What's interesting in New Zealand, they deregister on a monthly basis about 3,500 companies of about 70,000 notifications that they send out. So that means they have 5% non-compliance rate, and we think it's a lot higher at the moment. But we are sending out notifications as well. I have a dormant entity, and I received my notification for annual return compliance this morning. So I was very pleased, because it's the first time certainly that it's been sent out. So there are a lot of things that we are improving and that we've started with, and that I think this year will accelerate. On business rescue, there are no issues from our side. We're issuing the notice. We appoint the practitioners as required within the required time frame. We're required to register them or provide them with a certificate, I think, within 4 days. And generally, we are able to do that. In terms of the broader compliance, what we will do in the annual return report is provide you with a broader presentation of business rescue. In terms of the certificate, the compliance certificate, it's one of the things that we thought would be very easy to implement, but in fact wasn't so easy. And I think it goes back to the data and us understanding the data that we have and doing proper measurement. So I think this year, we're going to focus on one component, which is annual return compliance. Next year, we will focus on financial statement submission compliance, and that we will do it incrementally over the next few years. And then lastly, I just want to not so much acknowledge but concur with the sentiment you expressed, Chair, about it being taxpayers' money and that we need to treat it with respect. We think we need to treat it with respect, and we need to deliver value to people, because if people are paying fees to us, we need to provide them with not just a decent service, but with a good service. So that's what we aim to do. Is there anything you want to add?
Right. Other than that, you can still have, another round of questioning, if you have any, so that people are asked for a sensitive. All right. Honourable Slough, are you the only one? One, two. Honourable James, just two only.
I have only one question, Chair. The issue is, you register people, and of course there are compliance requirements in the registration. What is the difference in these compliance requirements with respect to big, small and very small businesses? Secondly, and what is your relationship with the cooperatives, seeing that they have their own cooperative act? Are they also registering through you, or do they have a registration, their own CIT somewhere? And how do you relate to other informal businesses, you know, historically informal businesses such as the hawkers, the liquor outlets in townships and villages and all of that, and many of such types of businesses? Thanks.
Okay. Just following on your answer to the question of company deregistration, and the fact that you say that you don't have accurate figures on this for reasons that are quite understandable and legitimate. But if we were to ask the question, how sustainable is business right now, how can we answer that question factually?
Okay, let me start with the question about compliance and the distinction between big and small businesses. In terms of the annual return compliance, the only distinction actually at the moment is the financial statement requirement, the requirement to submit financial statements. So, and because it's just a basic return, you just provide certain basic information. It's about updating some of your contact details, and it's about updating providing a turnover figure. And essentially the idea behind the annual return is that we, in the way it was envisaged and is envisaged currently, is that it's really a way in which we can tell whether or not you're active or not. But we think that quite a lot more thought needs to go into it, and as a tool we need to develop it a lot more. And I think we do need to distinguish, SARS distinguishes quite clearly between small entities and larger entities. And we think that in this process with SARS of working through a joint filing that we'll probably review in particular annual return requirements. So the more broadly in terms of the legislation, there is a distinction between the requirements, the compliance requirements for small businesses and for bigger businesses, especially businesses that either have a public interest and they are so large or have a broader impact on the public, and then businesses that trade with their shares in any way. But we find that 70% of businesses that we deal with are in fact just small businesses, one or two man businesses, and they generally don't need to transact with us very much. It's about registration and filing annually. So there's not a huge compliance burden on them. They can opt out of audit requirements. So I think that the legislative framework actually provides a lot more leniency for smaller businesses. In terms of cooperatives, we do register cooperatives. We also monitor compliance. We liquidate them. We review financial statements of cooperatives. And of course, we've been quite active. RECTA has been quite active in the whole legislative framework. So we are reviewing at the moment what the impact will be on our processes. Right now, cooperatives are registered manually with us. And I think last year we saw a big increase in the numbers, more than doubling, I think, of the numbers in cooperatives registered. So as part of the revision in the organizational structure, we are also almost doubling the number of staff in the cooperatives unit. And we will be looking at an e-filing opportunity. But the problem with cooperatives is that there are so many members, and I think it's not so easy to register them electronically. But that's one thing we'll be looking at. We don't relate really to informal entities at the moment. I think it's a choice of the informal businesses to formalize. And they are, of course, DTI is looking at a piece of legislation to register all businesses at the moment. So there are, of course, a lot of entities, sole proprietors. We always believe that SARS had a register of sole proprietors, but I don't think that there is actually a distinction. When we initiate the business names register, What we think we will have are individual sole proprietors that don't have, that are not registered, that have a trading name, who will register with us. And then, of course, there are entities that have a company name as well as a business name. So we think that we will be dealing with informal entities in that way. But it's not, whether or not you, we don't believe that all businesses need to be registered as a company. I think it depends on the nature of your business. And we probably have a fairly high level of formalization, I think, certainly for a lot of other countries on the continent. So I don't know if I answered your question. Okay. The last question related to how sustainable are the businesses. And we find that very hard to estimate from the register because we don't distinguish sufficiently on the corporate register right now what kind of corporate entities they are. We know that there are probably 30% of entities that are registered are shelf companies. We know that we have a relatively high proportion of companies that hold property, CCs that hold property, because we know we've deregistered a lot of them and have had to restore a lot of them. So what we would like to do is develop indicators on the register to distinguish those types of companies so that we can tell where is actual economic activity taking place. And also economic activity, it's about formal economic activity. So there's a lot of informal economic activity as well. The lady from the UK, we had an interesting observation yesterday, which was that in the UK what they've seen is that actually when in difficult economic times, more businesses register because they find that they need the protection of formalization during difficult times. So I'm not sure that a register is necessarily, you know, gives in any country such an accurate reflection of underlying economic activity, but that's one of the things that we think is going to be important going forward, that we are able to have better estimates of it.
Honourable members, I think we are coming to an end of this presentation. We have come to an end of this engagement with the Commission. So what I'm suggesting is that we have a 10-minute break so that when the next entity can set itself up, and then the food outside, we can just go and collect the complex so that by 5:30 we start rolling up with the second, with the third presentation. Thanks a lot for your input. All right, sure. Is here to, for the first time they come before the first floor for you. Is it not? The second time. When did they come? 2010. My son, for the first time I see this come back. Alright, honourable members, we can commence with the last presentation which is coming from this company. This company is led, ECIC, is led by Mr. Ngutu, and then he came with his partners, Senzani, what is that, how to? Senzani Mudawu, the CEO, and the CEO, Musupi. So here's the delegation in front of us. You can file on, you are welcome. It is portfolio committee. We are really interested in your work, because part of trading is the mandate of this committee. So we are interested in how our companies are performing as they go outside. So I can see that there is a lot of work we do in that area. So we are really interested in what are the opportunities, the challenges which are there, and what must be done to improve the intra-Africa trade, not only the intra-Africa trade, also the international trade in general. We've got the BRICS in our countries, extra countries and all those things. Just give us what we have to offer. You are welcome in this meeting. So the presentation is going to be done by Mr. Ngutu. All right, over to you.
Good afternoon, honorable members. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to present the strategic plan for ECIC, which is the Export Credit Insurance Corporation of South Africa. I think you've already introduced the delegation from our side, so I won't repeat that. I think, as we had indicated, the last time I had come to the portfolio committee was in 2009. It came previously, it was in 2008. It's a good opportunity just to restate what the mandate of the corporation is.
Our mandate to facilitate export trade and cross-border investment between South Africa and the rest of the world. And the enabling legislation which informs that mandate is the Export Credit and Foreign Investment Insurance Act of 1957, as amended. We operate in a legislated environment, in a heavily regulated environment. Firstly, we are a part company, established in terms of the Companies Act, and we operate like any other normal company in terms of having obligation to pay tax. But also the state-owned entity is subject to the Public Finance Management Act, but designated as a Category 3B entity. But because the nature of our business is insurance, we are then regulated by the Short-Term Insurance Act, which applies to all short-term insurance companies. So there's no special dispensation for us in terms of adhering to regulatory requirements. We then regulated by the Financial Services Board, which is there to protect the interests of the clients and the public, and to ensure that the organization is assuredly found to be able to meet claims should that eventuality arise. Our vision is to be the leaders in the medium and long-term export credit investment insurance business, focusing on customer needs and service management. Medium is 2 years repayment period and more. We have private sector companies like Credit Guarantee, which play in the short-term phase, which is repayment period less than 2 years. So the idea was that as a public state-owned company, we did not crowd out the private sector with the capacity to assist for short-term exposures. Our main mission is to facilitate and encourage African export trade, and we do this by underwriting export credit loans and investments outside South Africa, working with the South African contractors to enable them to win contracts when they bid internationally. So they're able to go to those bids and offer the technical solution, but go with the financing solution from a South African bank, all of them insured by us. We provide political risk insurance and commercial risk insurance to encourage these companies to go to markets which may prove to be difficult for them, like DRC, could be Ghana, Sierra Leone, so on and so forth. In order to achieve our mission, we have 5 strategic goals that guide us. With our main business is facilitation of export trade investment, but to enhance our capacity to do that, we form strategic alliances locally, regionally, and globally. That is important that we have a professional and competitive and customer-focused workforce that ensures effectiveness in implementing mandates and efficiency in how we use our assets. But as an insurance company, because we are carrying lots of risk, it's important that our risk management is on par. In that regard, we have a strong focus on enterprise-wide risk awareness and effective corporate governance and risk management practices. As an entity, it's important that we apply certain principles in international best practice. The way we derive these objectives is aligned from the overall government objectives. So this slide seeks to demonstrate the linkages between at the first level, at the overall government level, and how then those objectives link with the detailed objectives and eventually then translate to the objectives of the company. For instance, at the DTI level, there's a strong focus on building regional and global relations to advance South Africa's trade and industrial policy and economic development. Now, if you look at the first 2 objectives of EIC, they talk to that. Then you also say the level of DTI, there's a strong focus on building a professional, competitive, and customer-focused working environment that ensures effective and efficient service delivery. So if you look at objective 3, it also talks to that. So there's strong alignment between the overall government objectives, DTI objectives, and what we seek to do. In terms of the global environment in which we operate, I think we would be aware that obviously the EU remains the main trading partner of South Africa, and to the extent that the EU is going through an economic slump in the US, there's a need for South Africa to find new markets to expand trade opportunities. And that's where we play a role. We're looking at Africa, we're looking at other jurisdictions and other continents to facilitate companies going to those other markets. I think we have a focus on Africa as a continent, but given the positive growth that has been, you know, experienced for the continent, other international players have also seen that, and they're also coming to the continent, so the environment has become more competitive. In terms of challenges, because we provide quality-based insurance, we've noted that although overall there have been improvements in the democratization on the continent and establishment of peace and stabilization of conflicts, but there are still, you know, fresh points that still remain. There's still acts of political violence that one sees, whether it's terrorism or piracy. There's seen that in Nigeria and other places, or in Kenya. There's also outright outbreak of hostilities which continue in the DRC, sometimes in Sudan, between South Sudan and Sudan. And so Sub-Saharan Africa still remains a challenging geography to operate in, especially for South African companies that look to operate outside of South Africa. So our role then is to provide quality-based insurance in that regard. I think as we have indicated, Chair, you highlighted that there's a need to boost our intra-African trade. And we noted that most of what produced on the continent tends to be consumed outside, which is raw materials. There's a need then to find ways to open up trade opportunities through building infrastructure on the continent, whether it's road, it's rail, or ports, so that there's more opportunities for goods to travel between the different countries on the continent. So efficient border management, better regulation, and infrastructure development are some of the ways in which we can enhance that. And our role and involvement is more on the infrastructure development side. There are other agencies, obviously, involved in government, involved with regulation and border management. The overall trade opportunities that we see, as we've indicated, the continent remains our main market, with business opportunities in mining, infrastructure, industrial projects. And we do this by collaborating and coordinating between public and private players. We're not a lending company, we provide insurance. So we work with the banks, both the private sector banks, the commercial banks, and the DFIs such as IDC and the DBAC. Even then, you still need contractors, like whether it's Marion, Roberts, Group 5, you still need people who can build. So it's a package of all these different players who are able to compete against similar international competition on the continent. I mean, international ways, whether it could be a French consortium or a Canadian consortium looking for, you know, for contracts on the continent. So it is that package of support which we've been able to put together and compete internationally. I think the chair also highlighted with the BRICS, South Africa being part of the BRICS, and there's more collaboration between ourselves now and the export agencies of the BRICS countries. We've negotiated now with the Russians in that regard. And there are new opportunities where we see for value-added exports. To give you an example, in Sierra Leone, you have a mine that is owned by the Chinese, but now they need to build rail to help them to take the product to port. South African companies are involved on the rail side and also in providing locomotives. So that's the kind of value-added exports that you're able to leverage out of that arrangement, where the Chinese want the raw materials, but they need the infrastructure in those countries. And then we're able, through our locomotive sector here, to provide the goods for that industry. What is our overall positive advantage? It is our capacity to arrange large transactions on a long-term basis on the continent. I think ECIC as an export trade agency based in Africa, with a better understanding and higher risk appetite rather than the international counterparts. So that becomes a competitive edge. Secondly, we have the interest makeup scheme, which is funding from government, which is used then to help to make sure that the export coming from South Africa can be priced competitively. Third, as I've indicated, our contracting companies have the technology and technical capability to compete, especially in the areas of mining, engineering, and infrastructure. Fourthly, we have a banking sector that is quite active on the continent. Some have branches on the continent, which gives them footprint to access opportunities and then work in partnership with them. Lastly, as a South African government-owned entity, so behind our balance sheet there is government, so the banks and other players take comfort in buying our insurance. In terms of small to medium transactions, we've realized that on the whole, generally, most of the beneficiaries tend to be bigger corporations because of the size of the projects, these infrastructure projects being huge. But we've also noted that your small players tend to opt to participate in those transactions as subcontractors. But over and above that, we thought it necessary to build a special program for small transactions. And that regard, for instance, we partnered with the IDC for a performance bond insurance for SMME exporters. And the current initiative now to expand the rollout of this product, we have more direct beneficiaries, which are SMEs who can cover us directly for the product. And in line with the industrial policy action plan, we have a product for both buildings, where we help them, those who are involved in exports, where we help them to give them insurance for advance payment guarantees, which are normally required by the overseas buyers. Also insurance working capital facilities, because if an order is placed, we still need the funding to work on the boat and produce it. With that regard, we have enhanced the commercial recovery for those type of products up to 100%. Normal cover would have been 85%. In terms of the impact that we have, our activities have on the South African economy, a study was done with KDNG covering a period from 2005 to 2010, where they analyze the economic costs and benefits of transactions supported by us, taking into account the industry makeup that has been funded for those transactions. On the whole, over this period, 5.6 billion was spent on South African goods and services. I think this slide shows how much that funding of interest makeup, which is 900 million, was dispersed over that period. And obviously, this is a fund which we manage on behalf of the DTI. In the next slide, we then show the job opportunities that resulted and the GDP benefit that resulted. We show that overall, I mean, 7.8 billion, that was the overall GDP impact. I think we then looked at the cost of supporting closed interest makeup funds and the money that was used to buy South African goods, and show that the net benefit to the economy was 6.9 billion rand. I think this strategic plan covers a period of 3 years, and over this period we seek to pursue substantial growth and diversification of our portfolio. I think a significant rise in supported exports will help with job creation in South Africa and will help us to become more financially sustainable, to do more transactions. So the funds that we generate, we then plow back into the business to support more transactions. As I mentioned, the focus on rail, road, and ports of the continent without negating mining and other sectors. Our pipeline in the next 3 years is about 3 billion, but when you get to the targets, you'll see we've got very specific targets over the next 3 years. I think in this regard, it's important that obviously for the projected growth, the IMU budget should be able to match up the growth demand based on the growth of our portfolio. This slide just shows the projected net growth in the portfolio, because as new transactions come in, old transactions are tapering off. So we must not just look at the absolute numbers, but it's the churn effect within that portfolio. Even where the portfolio is being maintained, it means there's a lot of dynamism within that. New transactions coming in, old ones coming off. But I think you can see there that we're projecting quite significant growth from where we were before in the overall projects that we're looking to support. I think this slide talks to a target that are linked to facilitation of exports and investments. In terms of transactions to be approved, say in the first year we're looking at $720 million. Most of the transactions are priced in dollar terms, so sorry, we use that currency. Then by year 3, we expect that the approval will rise to at least 1 billion. I think this links up to the state of the nation in that we seek to then, through these efforts, to create more jobs and decent work and support small businesses as well. The next slide talks to the second objective of enhancing strategic alliances. In this regard, we have a strong focus, obviously, on the BRICS CCAs, and we started negotiations already with the Russians. Those negotiations will be expanded with other export trade agencies from Brazil and China. This is in line with the overall effort to grow the bilateral and diplomatic in economic relations between South Africa and the BRICS countries. It's important that even on the North-South basis that we don't ignore those countries like the EU and the US. We get invited to the OECD meetings where most of the export credit agencies from the North countries are located. So we continue to interact with them and we have various cooperation agreements with them. And part of the target there is to utilize those relations to have training initiatives and cooperation on business opportunities. The third strategic objective is about professional, competitive and customer-focused workforce. I think in this regard we want to enhance our marketing activities, focusing on potential new clients and existing clients. We have a roll-up program to all the different provinces where we present our products. So there's an active business development approach, and we also seek to build in-house research capability to advise the industry on opportunities for trade. So these are the targets which are linked to those particular activities where we talk about these sessions are more at provincial level, working with the various economic development agencies that are located at the provincial level. We're also focusing on the BE players. I think there's a need to support their entry into this export market, and we have specific targets in that regard. I think for us to be able then to implement the growth strategy that we set for ourselves, it's important to enhance capacity internally. So we're employing more people for that purpose to increase the capacity of the company because the business is likely to grow. Especially if you also try to serve the small business, then there's more volume that we anticipate in that regard. So we have a culture where we want to encourage innovation and quicker turnaround time. So we think that focus on payments management within staff and reward should be based on that. And there's a strong focus on training in order to empower staff to be able then to perform better. We have various targets that are linked to that, which is staff retention, training spend, and succession planning, where we identify critical skills in the company. I think these are HR targets which talk to team building, product job creating to create transparency, and design pay scales which create more transparency in how people are paid and fairness. I think there's a lot more of those targets which are focusing on performance management and training and transparency on the rewards. Then of the risk orientation objective, as I've indicated, are regulated by the Financial Services Board, and currently there's a review of the regulatory framework for the insurance industry, which also affects us. So we try to keep abreast with all the regulatory changes coming out of the FSB, and we have targets in that regard. I think we intend to grow our capacity to continue to support large high-tech infrastructure projects on the continent. So this slide just gives you a geographic spread of our exposure right now. As you can see, the bulk of it is on the African continent. There's some of it in the Middle East, and then the big exposure is in Russia. We also have presence in Indonesia as well. I think we go to those places where we are needed greatly. Obviously, in North America so far, there's not been a need for political stability. I think also we've seen when we started in the early years of the company, we were heavily concentrated in Mozambique, which is the blue slide at the bottom, portion there at the bottom, where we're 29% of the overall exposure. Over time, we've managed that exposure downward. And we do that by growing the business, by allowing more business in other countries. It dilutes the concentration exposure in a specific country. So we have specific targets on managing, you know, putting a cap on the level of exposure that we want to have in one country. I think as I've already indicated, the approach to manage for exposure and concentration is by growing into new markets. Not by calling it, but by growing, on a diversified basis. The last objective, which is effective stewardship. As I've indicated, it's important that we are a responsible corporate citizen in the context of South Africa. In this regard, we have introduced a corporate social investment plan,
which has a specific focus on education, skills development, and welfare support. Also, it's important that we play a role in the economic transformation in our country and enhance the participation of BE players and SME players in the export credit scheme. I think currently most of the beneficiaries are the established companies. Under corporate social investment, we have specific targets which look at training trends and with a clear focus on education, skills development, and welfare. I think as state-owned companies, it's important that play a role with apprenticeship, leadership opportunities, especially for the youth. As a company supporting exports, we will be focusing on those companies, the skills development of those companies that are engaging in the export market. We also have a program where we'll be assisting schools, building infrastructure, also Saturday schools, which focus on maths and science. We have very specific BE targets which look at our procurement activities, that we have a specific target on BE spend and the level of the scorecard which we seek to achieve. I think there's a strong focus which was highlighted in the state of the nation address that we need to pay SMEs within the BE. We've adopted that as one of our objectives. In our approach to the output and targets, obviously took into account the Treasury guidelines on smart targets, which makes sure that these targets are measurable and are within our reach. I think quarterly we report to the GTI on the progress on these targets. And those reports are reviewed by our internal auditor, which is Ngoki, and go through the Audit and Risk Committee. I think in the past financial year we've been very effective in growing the portfolio, which talks to the effectiveness of our system in meeting targets. As regards the National Development Plan, which is the vision that has been adopted now in our country, it shows there the link between what we do and what the NDP envisions. So our intervention will be in the area of facilitation of export trade and investments outside South Africa and building alliances at the local and regional level, focusing on regional integration efforts and international trade in general. I think this slide then highlights specific interventions that we are making. As the NDPN joins us to play a leading role on the continent, focusing on development and economic integration, our 35% of our portfolio is on the continent. And there's a win-win scenario in those projects, where the host countries are also benefiting, while South Africa benefits in terms of job creation and export earnings. So opening doors for our work, we're putting doors for South African companies looking for opportunities beyond our borders. So our package of insurance and trust makeup, that is the package of products we're able to use to open these doors. We focus obviously on private investment in labor-intensive areas. I've highlighted the boat building sector, but also at the rail locomotive sector where there are a lot of opportunities now, which we are looking at in Mozambique as well. The NDP talks about a professionalized public service. As a company, we've highlighted that we have a strong focus on performance, professional approach to performance, customer-focused approach, which seeks to ensure effective and efficient service delivery to our customers. There's a need also for state-owned companies to play a role in training artisans and technical professionals, and through our corporate social investment program, we plan to make interventions in this regard and assist students from poor families by offering bursaries, which cover tuition and accommodation as well. In terms of the budget, as a Schedule 3B entity, we run on a financially sustainable basis. And as much as we have government standing behind us, but the business approach is to ensure that we are financially sustainable. And the source of revenue for us, the revenue from premiums and investment income. The interest makeup fund is a transfer payment for the government, but this is not used to fund operations. This is a fund to manage, which then is best to external companies which are funding export transactions. So the projected growth in the ESIC's capital base is then used to underwrite more insurance.
you will see that our budget has expanded. It's in anticipation of this growth trajectory that we are making for ourselves. So you need then to have a capacitated workforce to be able then to implement the growth strategy. This talks to some of the numbers where the premium numbers, we anticipate significant growth in that. But also obviously with operating expenses, there will be growth to enable us to fund the growth strategy. I think as I've indicated, overall growth is in funding is plowed back to underwrite more exports. So the CAPEX spend, which over the budget period of about $6 million, large focus on this is on the IT to modernize our IT infrastructure to ensure operational effectiveness. And also we're looking for new premises because of staff complement growth and our current lease is expiring. So we're looking for a new building in this regard. So this cash flow statement gives more concrete numbers which are projected over 3 years to make sure that we're able to generate enough liquidity to be able to meet claims as they arise and then plow the retained income back into the business. I think to conclude on the presentation, Chair, is that we have equipment to ensure that Kosovo is prosperous and equitable and that we can assist to build a better Africa and a better world. And the way we do that is to work in collaboration with the private sector to grow exports and help with economic development. Thank you.
All right, you can turn off your mic. All right, honourable members, I think here's the... I'll take the hands down, indicate if you want to speak. I'll start here, Honorable Albert, Honorable McIntosh, Honorable Tawaza.
Mr. Speaker, I've noticed in one of the slides that you said that you play a role, you align your own goals with the NDP, and that you also play a role with regards to protecting human rights. Can you just expand a little bit on that, how you see your role in Africa over and above the commercial work that you do in being involved with human rights protection and enforcement? Thank you.
The Chairman, thank you and congratulations to Mr. Nkosho on just the kind of presentation I expected from an insurance man, quiet, modulated and risk-free. But I do have some questions in a general sense. First of all, as I understand it, Credit Guarantee does internal insurance, whereas you only do insurance outside of the borders of the Republic, as it were. Okay? If I could just get clarity on that. And then I would like to ask if you don't list how many defaults you have, I mean your bad debt. I don't suggest it may be a reflection on Mr. Mosupie as our risks officer, because hopefully it's minimal. But presumably you benchmark yourselves against other people in this insurance world. What interests me as a member of the portfolio committee, how efficient are you? Are we losing compared to other export countries? Then the other thing, you mentioned Africa a lot. Now my understanding is that the government gives considerable tax benefits and things to people who invest in Africa. And you can, SARS will allow you to include your African investment against certain tax deductions and so on. I don't know how you pronounce it, ECIC, export credit insurance. Export credit insurance, are you aware of those aspects? Then, do you fund, or rather, insure risks in agricultural development? I think we're all aware that a lot of South Africans are doing agricultural developments on a kind of basis negotiated with governments, and I think IDC is involved. Do you provide credit to agricultural investments? Then I was interested, you were talking about Sierra Leone. Now, we have recently discovered South Africa that there have been substantial investments by South African companies in a little country called the Central African Republic, of which the capital is Bangui. I wonder, Mr. Nkutu, if you could tell us, if you know, whether we have insured any of those South African companies' investments in Central African Republic, and what is Mr. Mosipio doing about it? Is he losing sleep over the dangerous risk there, or is he not? The last question is to, I think probably to Ms. Mutau, which is this cash flow on page 21. Now, I'm not an accountant, and the cash flow statements in the balance sheets are really confuse me. But what I don't quite understand is that you have a net acquisition disposal of investments. And again, please excuse my ignorance, Ms. Mutau. I'm not an accountant. I don't understand what that means. It's clearly income. So you are selling investments. Now, I know in the insurance world it may be an insurance investment. But please explain that to me. And also that you are looking at a good profit, apparently, on the cash flow position. But maybe you could just elaborate on that. And then the last and the very interesting thing is, and I don't know what the impact is on DTI, but it sounds to me as though we're going to have a real clutch of new buildings for all the different entities and things that DTI is involved in, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, Mr. Chairman, but it's interesting how there's another entity which wants to build a new building.
Honourable Thomas. Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. Allow me to be schooled a bit about this entity. I quite don't understand. The first time I am sitting in a meeting where they are making a presentation. I'm trying to understand are you insuring companies, South African companies, that are doing business outside South Africa? Is that what it means? In other words, if something happens to their product that they are exporting, that threatens their businesses, that's where you come in. That's what I would like to understand. You come in and save the businesses. The second question then linked to that is, if that is the case, have there been cases of fraudulent claims, and if there have been, how have you dealt with that? I don't know South African companies to be to be behaving in that particular manner, but just once or twice it might happen. Especially when you insure exports and investment to risky areas, as you mentioned in your page 5. The other question is on page 7, I see a big drop of transfer fares from DTI in 2007. What accounts for that big drop from 263 million to 70 million, and then it started to rise again, and then slumped a bit to 2010. And what has been happening between 2010 and now 9 in terms of transfers to yourself? Or from that moment you were self-sufficient and you don't need DTI backup, financial backup. I think that's the clarity that I wanted to
feature. Thank you. Right, thank you, Honorable Kwabaza. I think that I'll concur with Honorable Makinosh. This is one of the good presentations we had. There's a clarity. Also, the strategic plan itself is very detailed. But what I'd like to ask is the issue of the advocacy. How many people know about this?
how to reach out to the people so that they know about that. Because, you know, why I raise this question, because if the people you are, if you can look at such event, it's very clear that like also covering the people against the nationalization of their properties in the countries where they're doing business. You also deal with political insurrection as it arises. You know, after the experience of our farmers in Zimbabwe, after the issue of the land invasion there, they actually had to take some of the, they had to go to court sometimes. Were they not aware that there was such an issue which they could have taken so that they protected their property, so that if there was anything of that which happening, they'll be able to be compensated accordingly, or is it too expensive for them to take it? That's why the issue of advocacy is very critical. Are the South African businessmen and women aware of this, how to reach out to them? And then number two is the issue of assisting the schools, Saturday schools. Which schools are targeting? Are you only going to go around Central, or are you going to go straight to Kwakwa? Or to Zimbabwe and the Eastern Cape where Katana was born? Are you going to take any children from those areas, the deep rural areas which can be part of that, or the school, the Saturday school program? Are you going to support also the rural schools? Because if we want to develop this country, we must develop it as a whole. We know that there's a backlog. No, you go, it's a government divided into two. You go to your towns, your Rosebank, and everything is fine. But you go to your own quarter, you go to your own Eastern Cape, you go to your own Limpopo, you find that there's a lot of backlog. How to address, how to reach out to those places so that you give them the help which they need? Thank you, Chief.
Thanks, Chairperson. And I agree with all of you that this is a good presentation. So my question is, how does the new vision market of Africa and the BRICS in the export processes have the potential of expansion on your side? Do you see more of potential for you to grow bigger?
Thanks to the honourable members, thanks to the chair. It's quite a long list of questions, but make an effort to respond to all the questions that have been raised. I'll try to follow the order in which the questions came. The first question, it was on the NDP and more so on the human rights aspects. In what way we play a role on the continent? I think in this regard, I need to highlight the fact that on our own, we've adopted what we call Equator Principles, which is the international standard for doing big infrastructure projects. And the standard is a common standard that is used by the World Bank and the IFC, which is the International Finance Corporation, which set the international best practice for many of the development finance institutions funding projects internationally. What that does is it does not only limit itself to the host country standards on environmental and social issues related to projects, but it introduces international standards that cuts across. Most of the financial institutions operating outside South Africa also have adopted the standard, even the private sector banks. So as a company, we've been implementing that. Over and above that, through our participation and involvement with the OECD and other international associations where we operate, I think it got into a point where South Africa is adopting some of those conventions, which in a sense also talks to the issue of fraud and anti-bribery. South Africa has adopted the OECD Convention on Anti-Bribery. I just highlight that we draw a lot from the OECD standards as we seek to refine our activities on the continent. In this regard, the process that we support, we impose a condition on them that they comply with Equator Principles. That entails that in these infrastructure projects, there may be a need to move people. So where people are being relocated, the methods that the company uses that needs to comply with in the movement of people, they have to follow human rights standards. They have to give people alternative accommodation. They must have adequate compensation and all those things. So that is the human rights angle
that we're talking to. So there are various covenants in the policy which are imposed on the policyholders to adhere to those. And if there's breach, obviously there are consequences under the policy. So that's how we get involved. Then there was a question on how we relate to credit guarantee. Just confirm, yes. Credit guarantee, although they do have an export mandate, but overall most of their business is in the domestic environment. They provide credit insurance on a domestic basis. Also, they focus on the short term for payments shorter than 2 years, because they cannot take a long-term focus view on countries outside South Africa. But we've seen that in practice, sometimes they don't cover some of the clients in places like Zimbabwe or Sudan, and some of those clients knock at our door. But our mandate by design says we may support transactions for 2 years and more, so that we don't crowd players like credit guarantee. So that's how the market is like, so that the private players can play in that space, we can play in the medium to long-term space. I think there was a question on claims, whether are we efficient, what is the level of claims. I think when we formed in 2001, we inherited a lot of claims, which used to be, you know, underwritten by credit guarantee and reinsured by government. In places like Seychelles, for many years, we continue to pay claims. But the way we pay claims, if the loan was for 15 years, and there was a default on that loan due to political risk events, we say to a bank or financier, we'll pay you, we'll step into the shoes of the borrower and pay over the 15 years. So there's no lump sum obligation to pay claim once. So that way you can manage cash flow and the financial impact on us. So we continue to pay claims in places like Seychelles. We've paid the claim in Sudan as well. One of the biggest claims we've paid was in Kazakhstan, the mining project. But that claim in the overall scheme of things, I think the claims are less than 10% in the second elaborate on that, the percentage of claims, but it's less than 10% of the total premium that that we generate. So, in a sense, in the insurance business, it's still very important to have credibility. You should be able to pay claims. You should have claims and you should be able to honor claims so that people can, to make you a credible insurer. Otherwise, if you did this business and didn't pay claims, there's something we're not doing right or honoring our commitment to those clients. But yes, we have to manage those claims. And the way we manage those claims is when we approve transactions, we take into account countries that may prove to be difficult. We don't support each and every country under all circumstances. We are selective in a sense. For instance, car has been mentioned specifically. We don't have exposure in car in Central African Republic. There were inquiries in the horizon. We've been looking at that. Even before the outbreak of that coup, we're skeptical. I mean, we have in-house political risk assessment. We're skeptical about that. So we didn't support various inquiries that came through. So we have that capability of analyzing specific countries. Another example is Ivory Coast. Before there was change of government, they were projects, and we didn't have exposures in those places. Having said that, I mean, we accept that there will be instances where we might have a change of the political fortunes where we're already involved. So we accept that that is the niche of the business we're in. We'll then pay claims. There was also a question on agriculture, the agri sector, whether we're doing any projects in that regard. Yes, we do. We supported many years back a sugar cane project in Mozambique. We've also supported Lovo in Malawi. We've also done now in one of the projects, which is a biofuels project, in Sierra Leone, which is an agri project. And currently Mozambique is also supporting a banana project, which runs into difficulties. I think our experience with agro projects, they are much tougher. We are much happy that we continue to support those projects. The issue about the cash flow, I'll leave that at the end for maybe to comment on that. On the new building, I know that was a comment, but certainly it's not a foregone conclusion that we are purchasing a building. We have the option to lease where we are, located currently we are leasing. So we're looking at both at the lease option and the purchase option. So depending on which one is better,
we may choose to lease or may choose to buy. Then there's a question to clarify exactly what we do. Indeed, we support, we insure South African companies. It can be a contractor, an exporting company, it can be a bank, it can be an investor, somebody who takes equity investment. For instance, we've seen now recently IDC taking equity investment in a cement plant in Ethiopia. So they approached us for insurance for that investment. We do that in many other places, whether in Angola, South African investor investing in a waste product company for old waste, we're insuring them for that. So our insurance is clear that it's not just the threat of political risk. It must be an actual event that is okay, and there are waiting periods, which is normally 6 months, which gives us opportunity to trigger bilateral relations or interventions at the government-to-government level, where South African interests are present. So you're able, through DECO, leverage those offices and diplomatic relations. If it's expropriation, for instance, I think there is a recent case now in Zambia with South African interests, which were insured. There was an expropriatory event on the go. So you're able to leverage that so that remedial steps can be taken. But if those fail and the time lapses, yes, we have to honor the claim. So that's how we work. It was highlighted the issue of fraud. I think there's a lot of due diligence that goes into these transactions. I've also highlighted that South Africa adopted the OECD Convention on Anti-Bribery Measures, which has become law now in our country, for all these projects, even for foreign projects. So we implement in the application stage, part of our due diligence is to check the contractor if they are not on the debarment list of the World Bank and other international organizations. And also because we do this collaboration with banks, the banks go through the KYC process, which is Know Your Customer process, where they also FICA the clients. So they check them and what they do. And we make the contractors sign up to declarations. That in itself is a mitigation, but it's not a fail-safe intervention. People who want to commit corruption, yes, they may commit corruption underhand. There is always that potential risk. But we have come back provisions in the policies that if you have been found to have committed that corruption, then the policy will be terminated. You are breaching the terms of the policy. So there will be consequences. And we have an obligation to report those events to the law enforcement authorities. You were right in highlighting that in 2007 there was quite a drop in the transfer payments coming out of the interest makeup. That's quite notable. I think at that time, the interest makeup agreement that we have, because these interest makeup are regulated by interest makeup agreement that's agreed between government, ourselves, and the banks. That agreement had expired during that period. The new one had not come into place. So it took a while, more than a year, to get a replacement agreement in place. So during that period of years, there was a shortfall in the level of disbursement. What we've done now, which we just concluded now, this month, an agreement with the banks, and Treasury has supported us and DTI has supported us to make sure that the agreement now is an evergreen agreement. It does not get to last every 3 years or every 5 years. But there's a built-in provisions for review every 3 years by government. So there is a manner that you're not committed indefinitely without recourse. So every 3 years, government can look what are the implications on the budget, or the budget is tight, so government needs to be able to do that. But you're right in making the observation that it's important that this intermakeup fund is properly funded to match the projected growth that we're mapping out. So those periods of low allocations will not help us going forward. There has to be a mesh allocation, and we're engaging with government through the DTI in that regard, make sure that as we plan this growth, the funding of this interest makeup is also sufficient levels of commitment. And I think the ease of advocacy was highlighted. I think if you look at the strategic plan, when you have the opportunity to go back to it, you'll see that under our witnesses, we've highlighted this area. We said low profile of the organization. I say that even though there's been a program to roll out our
our products and market them through the economic development agencies in the different provinces and the business chambers. But on the whole, it still remains a niche industry, and there's still a need to market our activities more. And part of the budget is focused on these marketing activities, so we are going to increase that. You will see more of us, it will become more visible going forward. And I think the issue of Zimbabwe was sort of highlighted is how it happened that some of our farmers found themselves in trouble there and could not access this kind of insurance. There was a time period under the previous administration where the political situation in Zimbabwe before the global agreement was agreed was highly risky. It remains risky even now, but less than before. So until a bilateral agreement had been reached between South Africa and Zimbabwe, there were a period when we were stepping back from supporting projects in Zimbabwe. I think those farmers were caught before we were coming back into Zimbabwe. Currently, Zimbabwe is one of our fastest growing areas in terms of exposure. So we've come back to ensure projects in Zimbabwe. But definitely, we then look to see what is the level of relations between government, South African government, and that country before we get involved. I think there was a question on BRICS and new markets and where do we see potential for us expanding our business. I think I mentioned the example of Sierra Leone where the Chinese own the mining company and seek to take iron ore out of that country, and South Africa is able to support through infrastructure where our construction companies are able to build the railway line and supply locomotives. With a similar thing now, an opportunity now in Mozambique where a Brazilian company owns the coal and they want to sell it to a Chinese company, but they need the railway line running from where they got this in Mortis to the Beira port and to the Nacala port. So we're able to participate through the construction of the railway line and the supply of locomotives. So there are synergies. But I think we need to also be alive to the fact that there's opportunities for collaboration, but there's also potential competition. So we are alive to the fact that BRICS countries are also competing with us to a certain extent. Where there's head-on competition, the interest makeup and insurance and the coordination between SA players is very important so that we put a competitive package. Where there's opportunities to complement one another, definitely we want to collaborate on those and take advantage of us being part of the BRICS arrangement. Yes, in terms of rural schools, I think the CSI program we should introduce is a more recent introduction. We started off to roll out last year with supporting schools in Karagua and Mamelodi, but that's the first page. That's the first page in terms of the rollout. Definitely we will seek to cover all the 9 provinces and focus as well quite heavily in the rural areas. I think you can make sure that when our annual report will come back here, and it will include statistics from that, when, obviously, after this financial year which has just started, you'll be able then to see whether we've been true to this commitment. Definitely there is a commitment then to address the rural schools as well.
All right, if the other members of the team can respond, and then I'll give the department after that.
Thank you. I think in response to the question on the investment flow, obviously as an insurance company, our source of income being premiums. Most of that goes into investments, which are in the form of bonds, some of the money market instruments, and equity. Though it's a very limited position in equity, all of those things have different maturity profiles at hand. And also, the accounting standards obviously prescribe and say that if anything is maturing within 6 months, all of that must be classified as cash. Now, what would happen is from year to year, some of the particular instruments, because you'll see that what you see here, like less than year one, is only 1.6 billion. We still have 2.2 that's sitting under investments on our balance sheet. Now, at a point in time, some of those investments, like let's say close to year end, they can be liquidated and transferred. It's just like a move because the position is at a point in time is that much. Those funds that you see there are again, we can go back again and buy bonds. You won't see them under cash till now. It moves back onto investment. So it's sort of like neutralized, and it's just that this is a position that will be reflected as at the year end. Thank you.
The department can make a comment.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to respond to the Honourable Member's question about the buildings that our agencies mentioned that in their votes or in their presentations. The department took decision, in last year, to relocate the agencies off the campus. Previously, there had been a decision that all of the entities and all DGI and its entities should be co-located. I think that was a vision that was established and the building was conceived. Given that we share space with our sister department, Economic Development, I think there has been a decision to say, let's look at which agencies we can move off, because the two departments themselves are constrained in terms of space. And I think that there are discussions with the agencies in terms of procuring buildings, making sure that processes are followed. And I think we also will have an engagement with the agencies in terms of how do we rationalize that space so that we can get some economies of scale. Thank you, Chair.
Right, Honourable Members, we are coming to an end of the meeting. But before we close, I'll request the Secretary to indicate the program for next week.
Chairperson, the Subcommittee on BBBW will meet on Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock. The committee will be communicated in due course. And on Tuesday, we'll be dealing with DTI's annual ban, as well as the engagement with DTI on IPA will continue, because the Minister will present during that engagement. On Wednesday, DTI will respond to the public hearings on BBB, to the submissions that we received. And on Friday, we will have the engagement with BHB Bulletin, which was postponed for tomorrow. We will have it on Friday next week.
All right. Thanks a lot, Secretary. Honourable Members, thanks a lot for this vibrant engagement we had today. We know that we have to go to our constituents. But I think that your input was very invaluable. Also, thank the department for supporting the entities which are falling under it. Because continuously, there's no entity which has come here in front of us without the departmental officials accompanying it. We like that type of collaboration between the various stakeholders within the trading industry family. Also, thank you for this precise answer you have given and the work you have done. But as I said initially, the issue of advocacy is critical. The issue of rural development is one of the priorities of this government. So I know that when you put your minds around the issue, you can do something. Thanks a lot. The meeting is adjourned.